Electric bicycles are my jam. I'm turning into a nut for a good e-bike. It's easy to get around, we save gas not driving our car for short trips to the store, and I'm getting a little extra exercise. The folks at Velotric are sponsoring a series of videos on my channel to show off some affordable e-bikes and help people get up to speed. It's easier than you think, and prices have never been more competitive. You can catch those videos on my YouTube channel, but if you're interested in shopping an e-bike, head over to velotric.bike/somegadgetguy and look at their road bikes and fat tires. Again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. If any of those bikes look good to you, you can save an additional $60 off an already low price by using the coupon code SOMEGADGET60, SOMEGADGET60 at checkout. Once again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy and coupon code SOMEGADGET60, and I thank Velotric for being a sponsor on this show. It would help if I turned on my mic, but I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I take 1 week off, and I am so off my game. I mean, you're like setting everything up. I thought I had everything prepped. We're getting into the last minute of the countdown. And you're like, oh, shoot. I've got to like share it on social media. Like, make sure my microphone works. Hey, I hope everybody's having a fantastic time. Last week, I was in the middle of some travel for some personal stuff, some family stuff. And unfortunately, I couldn't do a live stream, but we did share kind of another sort of epic video essay that got published last week, talking about 10 years of ridiculous Apple hype. Not even Apple's fault, like an entire industry run completely amok, hyping products that have never existed, telling consumers not to buy things that do exist because Apple might make something. And it's a real bad look for us tech journalists out there, me and my fellow tech brethren. So from last week to this week, so much news, tons of stuff have passed over my desk, across my screens. We've got an incredible collection of news links. And today is also my daughter's birthday. So my daughter, Lex, she turns 8 today. We're planning festivities and celebrations, and there will be lots of ice cream cake to be consumed. So we're doing pretty good. Some good family travel, some fun events, and we're still peak Techtober. Of all the things that we can talk about in the era, this area of consumer electronics. So there's going to be some really fun stuff coming to the channel in terms of that too. So I hope everybody has been having a lovely time, lovely week. I'm glad we finally get a chance to catch up, and we're going to catch up on a monster show. So especially once we start getting into the second half, I've got some thoughts on the Pixel 8 Pro. If you have questions on Pixel 8 Pro in the second half, we're going to be talking about that. I have lots of thoughts on the OnePlus Open. As we get into the second half of the show, if you've got some questions on the OnePlus Open, let's ask them. And also, because if you'll pardon just the quick detour, I'm going to tangent my own tangent already here. Boy howdy, is the OnePlus Open riling up Samsung Knights and hardcore Apple fans. Like, I got another comment from someone I muted this morning, basically calling me a shill, and you didn't call your video review, so that means OnePlus has told you everything they want you to say, and everyone out there should just buy an iPad. And the day before, it was another Apple fan who was like, oh, but, you know, I've already heard that in days, you're going to have all these busted pixels on your screen. And I was like, well, I've been using it for a couple of weeks, so it's going fine. Couple of weeks? Come back to me when it's older. And you're like, you just said that I would see failed dead pixels in a couple days. So you're really bad at the poop talking here. I've just been cutting people left and right. People are up in their feelings about the OnePlus Open. And I feel like we should share some stories and chat about that as we get into the second half of the podcast. We have a ridiculous amount of tech news. I do want to spend some time kind of looking back at some housekeeping, because I didn't get to do any housekeeping last week. And I'm sure I'm probably going to get derailed as we make it through part of this commentary. This is a really heavy news block, and I'm going to really work to try and abbreviate a lot of it. So let's tackle some housekeeping. First up, I just want to say hello, everybody. I'm seeing an incredible collection of familiar names and faces. Ghost Starscream, Farhan, Brian Glaze, Barry Johnson, J-Man150, Simon Says Hypno, Ownscon, ER1980, Gabaletta, Zhaobotnik, Kappa Cash, J-Man, I think I said J-Man, did I say Gabaletta? I'm already off of Farhan. Dave Burns! I'm sorry, I know I'm skipping over some people. I saw Vazikos. Ron Guido, there was another one. And then I also have to throw my Juan Doesn't Have a Soundboard Fanfare of Glory to Colonel Corn Pop, who subscribed to Prime. This is our one-year anniversary, Colonel. Subscribed for 12 months now on Twitch, on Prime. Thank you so much for supporting and continuing to go down these rambling diatribes of tech tomfoolery. Yeah, ER1980, your lips to God's ears. People need to stop worshiping brands. Sure, if you have a preference, that's fine, but either call them out or accept other brands are better at some things. And my favorite thing has been like the people, oh, sure, you're going to say the OnePlus Open is the best now, but what about in the future when new products come out? As if like when someone says, hey, this is like my favorite phone or this is the best phone right now, I obviously mean it forever will be the best, indomitably. Because I guess that's how Samsung Knights think. All right, we've got tons of housekeeping to chew through here. So here, I'm going to screen share. I'm like looking back and forth between both of my monitors here. I'm going to screen share here. This was a mega video that I didn't get to chat up last week. What you really need to know about XR glasses. And I was stoked. The folks at TCL sponsored this video, but also let me kind of dig at Apple. This is like the most confrontational sponsored video I've ever been allowed to make with a brand saying, yeah, let's do it. So the title, Apple Doesn't Own Augmented Reality. And basically, this is just sort of a primer. If you've been curious about what it's like to put a display on your face, it's to help deliver some of the metrics that are important. So you're going to see a lot of big numbers in one area or resolution over here, but resolution free of other context doesn't help you make a purchasing decision. And also for things like, oh, but you have to have a cable plugged into your glasses, but what about battery life on a mixed reality headset? You know, if you build the battery in or if you have a soap on a rope battery like the Vision Pro, well, you're dealing with a completely different set of circumstances. And every single time I bring up these glasses, I get a lot of comments from tech enthusiasts, people who think that they're tapped into tech, who do not, fundamentally do not understand what this, what these products are like, especially opposite more like mixed reality headsets. So I get a lot of Quest people coming in like, oh, but why would you spend $350 on these glasses when you could buy a Quest 3? And you're like, well, can you put a Quest 3 in your pocket? I mean, you understand that making something smaller often means it's more expensive for that kind of manufacturing. But they don't, because they came just to say, I have a Quest, you should pay attention to me. Early access on the Patreon right now is a OnePlus Open versus Surface Duo 2, an unfair folding fight. I did this for the Pixel Fold. I had to do it for the OnePlus Open also. These bendy, foldy plastic screen devices are getting a lot better, but there are still some critical lessons that I feel all of these manufacturers and Google making the software could have learned from Microsoft's implementation of making a dual display mini tablet. Another important, these are Patreon exclusives. I tried to publish them publicly or make videos about them and no one ever watches it and it's way too much work. But if you're a member of patreon.com/somegadgetguy, you can also get my early benchmarks. Pixel 8 Pro versus OnePlus Open, Tensor 3 versus Snapdragon 8 Gen 2. And we break down all the stats beyond Geekbench. I've been running the video rendering, actually video trimming is now becoming an important test for me to run because one of the other, oh, sorry, Patreon exclusive, you can see how Tensor 3 compares against 8 Gen 2, Dimensity 9200 Plus, and the Tensor 2, so I've got a mix-up of different phones, and one of the reasons why that was important was in all of these complex tasks, whenever you're benchmarking stuff, and I think folks in this chat, you're probably familiar with like Gamers Nexus and Hardware Unboxed, like the hardcore deep dive, let's really dig into the nuts and bolts of PC reviewing and PC benchmarking. Those guys do incredible work because the most important part is being so consistent. But the thing that messes you up in every generation of doing benchmarks are things like optimization. So one of the apps that I test for batch photo processing, Photomate R3, recently ran an update that boosted performance between 10 and 20% depending on the phone and the chip. So now my older benchmarks don't apply because that's not the relevant performance you would get today. So one of the other critical, and this one was huge, one of the critical updates I posted on the Patreon with a little bit of write-up, but you can catch this. It's a YouTube short. The video part is public, but my additional information is on the Patreon. Google Photos got a huge speed increase, and I was so excited to see this. Now, Google Photos is still a mess of an app. It's a great service for people who like how Google organizes photos and videos, but the actual app on your phone is kind of hot garbage. Go in to do something like trim a video file. This should be really easy. You get two little sliders, and you cut the head, you cut the tail, and you end up with the clip that you want. The way that Google does it is in such a poorly compressed preview image that it's super difficult to see where you're putting those cuts. And then when you take your finger off, it jumps somewhere else in the timeline randomly. So you can't see if you actually cut until you play the video to see that the cut is exactly where you wanted it to line up. There are still horrific structural problems with Google Photos, the app. But one of the things that they've really improved upon is the rendering performance. So now when you cut a little video clip in Google Photos, it is 4 to 5 times faster than it was a month ago. And that's how quickly these things have been changing over. So for 2 years, Google Photos would take longer to process a video than it would take to play that video in real time. An iPhone SE 2020 can accomplish the exact same task almost twice as fast as where we were with Google Photos a month ago. And now, I actually do a real-time test of my video trimming. So this is the exact same file I do for all of my benchmarks. I trim it in LumaFusion, and I trim it in Google Photos just to show the differences. And what used to take over 2 minutes for some phones to trim a two-minute video clip can now be done in 30 seconds. So it's a speed increase of like 4 to 1. Over where we were before. So that one was really exciting to follow up on. Obviously, we're going to be talking about this in the second half. A lot of noise. I did a twofer with my buddy TK Bay, where we both have the OnePlus open, and he focused more on gaming and entertainment. I focused more on productivity and getting work done. Where is the other? Oh, and then also, because I got to take that little trip, and I wasn't here streaming last week for the podcast, I have some fun photos of the Albuquerque International Balloon Fiesta as seen through the lenses of the Pixel 8 Pro. So my very, very, very early first impressions on the Pixel 8 Pro camera, also on the Patreon. And a lot of that footage is going to make its way into my proper review and my camera deep dive, but that's the first taste, that little glimpse right there if you want to check it out. And then because I already mentioned it, I just have to highlight it again that this was almost a couple months of work to put together. I hate doing video essays. These long form examinations, the traffic dies immediately once you put it on YouTube if your channel isn't known for doing long form video essays. But this is something I've been threatening to do since I did my Samsung podcast, you know, 90 minutes of market abuse from Samsung, 10 years of out of control hype, Apple tech journalism, and an out of control hype train. And so that this is public. You can catch it on YouTube. You can catch it on somegadgetguy.com. And of course, the earliest part of this conversation happened first on the Patreon, as I actually did my script preview of this. I actually had people read the script on the Patreon, and I got some good feedback in my DMs on where to take this presentation. Whew. I missed one other. So there's just so much going on. A pivot for my channel. I'm really getting into consumer affordable AR, so mixed reality and XR glasses. And then I'm getting really lit up about mini PCs again. And last week, I wasn't here to talk about my little review of the Geekom A5, a tiny little AMD machine, kind of in that Nook form factor. These things are getting incredible. So every single mini PC that I've reviewed over the last couple of weeks has sort of leapfrogged the one before it. So I did one video on some Atom Lake. I did a video on 11th gen Intel. Now here's AMD. It's two generations old, but two generation old AMD. And I just got a shipping notification for a follow-up. Another brand is looking at doing a current Ryzen 7. So there's going to be a lot to talk about there. And I've got some ideas for things like mini servers, you know, photo server replacement, NAS style use, and I'm hoping I can put together just some quick and dirty, rip open this, put this in there, close it up, put the software on, and you too can do this kinds of videos. These little mini PCs are becoming stellar, just incredible bang for buck options. So that's all the housekeeping. 9:16 in the a.m. Usually I'm starting my housekeeping at 9:15. All of the links, everything that we're going to be talking about, all of the show notes, housekeeping, everything that's going to be on this week's podcast blog post, somegadgetguy.com. Oh, Zalbotnik, this is killing me right now. What I don't like is how Google Photos advertise Google One and you need that for some extra editing tools. So who else is... So I don't pay for Google One anymore. I have a family plan with Microsoft for OneDrive, so I'm going to be the Microsoft 365 shill, but it's such a good deal. It's like $100 a year for five accounts, a terabyte of storage per account, all of the Office apps. We need it for work, both my wife and I, we need it for work. And so I really let Google One lapse. I mean, the price for storage just really did not make sense when I was already doing everything through OneDrive. And so... lately, because I canceled my OneDrive, because I canceled my Google One and I'm leaning on my OneDrive, every single time I open up Photos, it's now saying, hey, do you want to back up some photos? And I'm like, no, Google, I don't. Well, how about you just back up some select photos? And now it's a two-stage nag screen to get through. And you're like, this makes me even less inclined to give you money, Google. You can't neg me into wanting to subscribe to YouTube. You can't neg me into giving you money for Google Photos. If you make the better service and you can be price competitive against OneDrive and you can finally make it easier for me to share things on OneDrive, because I don't know if people really fully understand this, but every single time you share something on Google Drive or Google Photos, it is such a pain in the butt. It sucks so bad. It's easy for you to send it, but then the recipient, oh, I wasn't logged in with this account, or I need to get them to approve this other thing that I've logged in, and you just can't get to the file. On OneDrive, I say, give this person this file, and Microsoft goes, cool, you must want them to be able to click on this link and view this file, and you're done. And it's over. And so I've moved over to sharing files on my NAS, because my NAS is the same way. I can set up a password, I can tell people what the date and the time range is, and I can say, here's the file. And then they click on a link and they get the file. On OneDrive, I upload a file, they click on the link, they get the file. On Google Drive, someone sends me a link, and now I've got to jump through three or four hoops and then send a reply to the person, oh, you didn't approve my account, but you sent it to this email address, and now we've got to do this dance. And it's stupid. So I just missed the in all of this rambling. I have to throw another wah, bah, 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 bah. Juan doesn't have a soundboard. Fanfare of glory to Simon Says Hypno, subscribed for 30 months, currently on a 7-month streak over on the Twitch. Thank you so much for supporting, for sticking with me, and for continuing these conversations, Simon. I really appreciate it. So, why don't we knock out some news? Oh, I'm still on here. There we go. Brian Clay, sorry, I just got that. Come on, Juan, Google said pretty please. Twice. Do you want to back up your photos? No. Do you want to back up these photos? No. And, oh, because that also reminds me, this didn't make the show notes this week, but it was one of the news. If you're backing up your photos on Google Drive and you're a photo nerd like I am, be really careful with what photos you save now, because Google is automatically backing up your RAW files. So it's not just JPEGs. They seek out your RAW files, upload those to Google Photos, which will triple or quadruple the amount of storage on every photo you take now. Because you weren't eating up your storage fast enough for them to charge you for more storage, now they're expanding the auto-upload process, and it doesn't look like there's an easy way to customize exactly what folders and files get backed up. Whereas I've got this gimmicky app for my NAS that I say, go to this folder, upload these files, and when I'm plugged in and on Wi-Fi, make sure I've backed everything up on my phone. And my NAS goes, cool, and then we're done. And if I don't want to back up the raw files, I know I don't move them to the folder that I want backed up. It's real easy. And it's just such a shame that for Google employing all of those amazing and talented software engineers and developers and just this huge base of knowledge, they can't figure out conditional backups and conditional uploads. It's just boggling that they're so bad at that. Well, I'm going to take a sliver of coffee here. This is me not caffeinated enough. Let's see if we can get this thing really cooking here. Hold on one second. All right, we got some FCC news. We don't have to spend a lot of time on this because it's the beginning of a beginning. Zhabotnik, I use QNAP. All right, so screen sharing back again. Oh, I did not format my browser page correctly. Let's put that right there. From my eternal man crush, John Brodkin, over at Ars Technica, FCC moves ahead with Title II net neutrality rules in 3-2 party line vote. So, Federal Communications Commission today voted to move ahead with a plan that would restore net neutrality rules and common carrier regulations of internet service providers. In a 3-2 party line vote, the FCC approved Chairwoman Jessica Rosenworcel's Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, NPRM, which seeks a public comment on the broadband regulation plan. The comment period will officially open after the proposal is published in the Federal Register, but the docket is already active and can be found here. And by here, there's a link in the Ars Technica article. We should just call them Ars Technicals. Ars Technica articles are Ars Technicals. Yeah, that works. So, this is the beginning of the beginning for what took over a decade of legal wrangling with the original Open Internet Order, which was voted on and installed under the Obama administration, was dismantled in the first year of the Trump administration, and now we begin the process of trying to restore this under the third year of Biden's first term. They stalled installing a new FCC chair for 3 years of Biden's administration. So now begins the process. We're going to start asking for public comments. We're going to start working towards finalizing and ratifying these rules yet again. And this is one that I feel crosses party lines. If you're liberal or conservative, what you want in this current economy is some sense of consistency. And it is better to have the FCC, which is a woefully underfunded commission under the federal government, in charge of reactive regulation of harm on the internet. And I do not believe what you want is every state in the United States having different rules for how we manage online communications and what purview carriers have over this infrastructure. And if you recall, a little while back, it was about a year and a half ago, someone please correct me on this, the FTC published a report of the vast overstepping of carriers and ISPs collecting every single bit of information that you interact with on the internet and selling that off to data brokers. And their main proposal in combating this was to properly empower the FCC to regulate this telecommunications space. So we have two commissions that are basically in charge of trying to manage consumer harm and consumer abuses through much larger organizations and corporations, both saying we need a little work here. So hopefully we don't see too much pushback on yet again installing something that should never have been removed in the first place, served no consumer benefit, and was actually bad for businesses in the long run, as every business that wanted net neutrality and Title II regulation scrapped had to deal with multiple lawsuits at every stage of state government across the United States. So when you think about why we keep seeing rate hikes and fee increases while CEOs and shareholders make more money and there are more stock buybacks, part of the reason is you're also funding their legal actions. Look, their lawyers' billables are trickling directly down into what you pay for having TV and internet and home phone and all that fun stuff. Did I say home and home phone? I meant mobile and home phone. So FCC is getting it started. Now we need to keep an eye on how this entire process goes. And we know that there's going to be a whole bunch of weak Ted Cruz style, they're going to take over the slippery slope of monkeys getting married, internet scary, and it's just going to be word salad from people who don't understand anything about how the internet is a series of tubes. Moving right along. Oh, Yar 2084. I think this is the great and poopification of all of our services now. Yar says Microsoft stuff is too ad-riddled for my liking. Google apps for the win. If you're upset about Microsoft ads, and you're trying to say that Google is somehow objectively better, even Apple is now serving ads. There are pop-ups in your dynamic island about what kind of financing you can get on the new iPhone. Every single one of these major tech corporations is squeezing you right now. So you might be familiar with Google's style of advertising in Google Docs or in any of their other services. But to think that they're not applying the same kind of pressure, like, oh, hey, do you want to try Edge? Edge is a good browser. It is. I really wish Microsoft would stop trying to, like, tease me into using it or force me into using it, but it's a fine product, and I feel like it deserves a little bit of a nudge given the dominance of Chromium, especially Google Chrome specifically, but Chromium browsers in general. It's all the same. we can get our ire up on Google. I mean, I'm sorry, we can get our ire up on Microsoft and Windows 11, but it's the same. It's the same on Apple. It's the same on Google. And until we see some other sort of disruptive play, or until we can really find that nerd hook that gets Linux taken off, advertising and this invasive style of advertising is just going to be a consistently common aspect of using any type of compute platform in the modern era. So, we've got this one I'm going to break down quick because we've got a pair of stories that I feel are very critical for folks who still seem to think that investing time, effort, energy, and money into their Twitter following is in any way good. And then I really want folks to follow up on the data. So I've got all three of these linked in the show notes when you catch the replay or you come back to my site, somegadgetguide.com. But basically, Twitter is a cesspool. I don't know if anyone has noticed, but I have pulled my stream from Twitter this week, and I will not be streaming on Twitter, where there used to be kind of the Periscope thing, and then it just became a part of Twitter directly. And I'm not getting any traffic or any interaction or any engagement from that. So why not? I'm on Restream to stream this out to a couple of different platforms. Why not give Restream a break and delete one server that they don't have to support anymore to spreading content that Twitter is sitting on because their algorithm crushes our stuff if we don't have the check mark now? That was really rambly. So here are the stories that I'm going to get us through quickly, remember, with all that preamble. First one by the Canadian Press. CBC mainly remains off X, citing low traffic 6 months after scaling back presence. Who wrote this? I think the photo is Rick Reichott, but I can't see who the byline is. Oh, it was right up there. Mickey Jurek over at the Canadian Press. 6 months after the Canadian Broadcasting Corp and Radio Canada scaled back its use of the social media site X, the public broadcaster says it will mostly remain off the platform formerly known as Twitter because it doesn't bring in a lot of traffic. And wouldn't you know it, we just recently did the same thing over at NPR. So this story I caught first from The Wrap, written up by Eileen Connolly. NPR lost only 1% of its web traffic after leaving X. The social media platform had provided a mere 2% of NPR's traffic before a, quote, state-sponsored media tag sent it packing. For some reason, we keep dispensing this myth that Twitter of today still fills some of the role that Twitter of before used to fill. Twitter used to be the place to find the shoutings and ramblings of people in that moment, free of the algorithm standing on your neck. Joining a conversation in that moment meant you were a part of something happening right then. Twitter has always been a cesspool. Twitter is the equivalent of walking into Grand Central Station and people screaming every thought they have in their head at the top of their lungs. But you could navigate Twitter to create a platform tailor-fit for your inane ramblings. These are the types of crazy ramblings and screamings that I like, so I can follow these people, and that's what my timeline is pieced together with, and that's actually really good as a platform for things like news. Something incredible happens, you can swarm in, and you're getting someone's accounting of that in the moment, but it has now become the best place to spread misinformation and to weaponize disinformation. And we're still warning this platform across international regulators, oh, you've got to scale this back and people are going to get hurt and this is contributing to people getting killed. Tisk, tisk, tisk. And we know how much Elon Musk really hates having regulators wag their finger at him. But that's kind of the reality of where we're at. So many of the people that are still on Twitter make this claim as if like, oh, well, I'm going to stay on there to be a good data point, and you're going to fight bad information with good information. And you're like, you're going to lose that war. I've been in too many live streams with like this kind of faux libertarian Silicon Valley tech bro conversation from people older than me who you would think would know better. Well, you can't infringe on free speech and you can't do this and you can't do that. You'll lose the war of ideas. Like, no, you're just on Twitter still because you've got a book to sell. You're still on Twitter because you've got tens and tens and tens of thousands of followers. You can go anywhere else and you can engage and you can host these conversations, but you're choosing this platform because you're too lazy to rebuild somewhere else. And that's fine, but call it like it is. Don't act like you're doing this for some noble cause of like righting wrongs. You're just delivering engagement to a dead platform that's basically zombified. Twitter is dead. It is X. And whatever that means to someone, it is it went from being a fun cesspool that you could kind of cordon off and create a platform of your own to just being an open, actual cesspool. So, if you need data, because right now you're just listening to me ramble on, right? Because these are just my feelings. It's not like there's an incredible amount of data dug up by people who are really good at organizing this information. Oh, wait, I have that link here too. So DSG, and they do some marketing and brand work, snapshot of the Twitter migration, and they've been filing quarterly reports since Q4 2022. And let's click on the Q3 2023. This is going to take a second. I should have loaded the PDF before we got into this. But talking about the executive summary, some of the really reprehensible alt-right commentators that are making a ton of money because of Twitter Blue subscriptions, paying them to tweet horrible, horrible things, some of the downfalls of the company, some of these metrics that they've been lying about, all of their active users. And then when we keep going down here to bar graphs, we can see like there's been a huge plunge in just the brand recognition. And we talked about this a couple weeks ago. If Dunkin' Donuts added a chat with your friends feature to the Dunkin' app on Android, I still believe, someone check the charts right now, but I still believe that would be a more downloaded social network than X is right now. X fell below the Dunkin' Donuts app. That's how much he's tanked the recognition and the brand image of this platform, of this service. But there is gobs and gobs of data, steep drop-offs. There's no confidence in the executive leadership because we know that they're just puppets. estimates of web traffic. We're seeing the growth of other services, where this traffic might be coming from, the hilarious attempts at trying to, I don't know, stir up unwill against regulators and people that examine hate speech on platforms, vaccine misinformation, failed live streams. Elon Musk can't host a live stream to save his life. And just, it keeps going and going, and it's all super well linked. And look, here's someone who is purposely spreading misinformation about terrible, terrible situations in the world, also sharing that they made $12,000 that month by sharing terrible information that hurt people. And that's what X has become. So if you're looking anywhere else, like, I'm not going to say go to Threads, because that's Facebook, and we know what Facebook is. But there are other platforms, and there are other opportunities to join these conversations, to share these conversations, and to engage with people and platforms. And this is one of the ones that I love. So as you look at mentions of alt socials in bios of active Twitter users, we see this humongous spike in people adding Mastodon links to their profiles, which I'll probably end up doing here soon, too. So this isn't just, oh, it hurts my feelings that Elon Musk is going after those liberals. Oh, I'm one of those liberals and he hurt my feelings. Nah, there is literally no data to suggest that any of this is functional over at Twitter. The entire experiment has been a complete cluster and it's failing rapidly right before our eyes. So we can sit there and munch on our popcorn and have the Schadenfreude of watching the train wreck play out in real time. But at the end of all of this, what we're here doing right now with the people who are viewing this live stream and in this chat right now is we want a place to hang out and to talk and to share good information and to also like dig a little bit deeper. And it's not going to be Twitter. If you're still trying to make Twitter that, every single day, Elon Musk's leadership is taking that away from you, taking you another step away from what it was that you thought you liked about Twitter. And it kills me the most because Twitter was my jam. That was my, after the collapse of Google Plus. So, if you're signing up for a new account on Twitter, go pay your buck so that you can verify you're not a bot. Good plan. Let's really see if we can give Elon Musk more money. Shifting gears, another frustrating aspect of the corporate culture that is surrounding so much of our commentary and media. I haven't been keeping up with the problem with Jon Stewart. Seen some really great video clips, especially his interviews. Jon Stewart's interview style is still second to none in putting politicians on the spot and making them defend their actions and defend what they've said. I've never seen anyone quite so skilled at cutting to the quick, at least not in the modern generation of me consuming news. That's mostly what I've been. I haven't really caught up with the rest of it, the sort of quasi podcast that they were putting together. And I didn't love the sort of ensemble of commentators that they had sort of surrounding him, because it felt a little like old man Stewart talking to them millennials, but they weren't really millennials. They were like Gen Y or Gen Z or whatever they were calling them until they defined for themselves what they want to be called. Sorry, another rambling lead up to Apple. Apple is canceling the problem with Jon Stewart. And this is an article that I dug up first from Deadline, but it's actually been followed up a little bit on over the last couple days. This was by Peter White over at Deadline. The problem with Jon Stewart has been canceled at Apple after two seasons. The New York Times, which first reported the story, said the move came amid creative differences between the former host of The Daily Show and the tech giant. Topics such as China and AI reportedly were causing concern among Apple executives, the paper said. And we keep quietly just sort of tucking that last little bit away. It's like a little mention, like, oh yeah, you know, Apple, they had some concerns about the direction the show was going, some of the editorial, you know, China, AI, but you know, no big deal. It's Apple. They make good stuff. And you're like, okay. So what we're looking at is obviously a comedic news commentary show. I don't think Jon Stewart has ever considered himself hard news, right? He is a comedian who comments on trends and comments on the news. But we're not even trying to sort of mask what these conflicts are anymore. Apple doesn't seem to have a problem sort of contributing to these platforms and saying things like, well, we don't like what you're going to say, so we're just going to cancel your show. And that we can so directly mention specific topics like China and AI. AI is the hot buzz word in investing right now, and shareholders are really cranky pants if they don't hear your company has a new AI strategy. And I feel like we're almost to the peak of AI craze, right? There is no sustainable business model for AI in the way that we're pitching it. It is very much becoming another structure like crypto or NFTs, that there's this big boom, there's this big bubble. Obviously, the technology is going to stick around and we're going to find things to do with the technology, but how do you make money on it? The incredible amount of compute power necessary to build these experiences, which are okay, like they're pretty good, they're fun, they're interesting, but they're still toys. The concept of regurgitating styles of language and speech is not a business model, especially when you factor in how much power it takes to do that. Literally electricity. Like, I'm almost positive it was kind of a joke between people internally at Microsoft, but there was that sharing of messaging between people at Microsoft inquiring as to whether or not they could build their own nuclear reactor to power their AI initiatives. I don't think that that was a serious executive push to become a part of the nuclear energy community, but it sort of helps quantify what Microsoft is looking at when it comes to data centers full of servers and the ability to create this content. And the novelty of it is starting to wear off. Plus, we've also had those court cases. So if you have this generative content, can't really copyright it. You can't really legally protect it. You have to have humans involved in the creation of the content anyway. And all of the companies that are looking at AI as a way that they can cull their labor force. Hey, we can get rid of these types of producers and these writers, and maybe we can even use generative AI actors in this space. They want to reduce costs, but they're not going to be happy if they can't copyright the content that comes out of it. They can't protect it. And then what's to stop someone from using that same tool set to rip off their IP? So the people who hold all the money are really interested in a part of this conversation because it would save them money, but they're really not interested in the final leg of this destination where they would lose out on money because people would just start making their own stuff. Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to SomeGadgetGuy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch. So, Ghost Starscream, generative AI, more like evil-ative AI. I mean, because the thing is, it's really cool, and it is really fun, but it's not what they're selling us. it's not the solution that they're claiming it is. And I feel like just like NFTs, just like the crypto market, it's yet another, not quite the same kind of rug pull as NFTs because of the way that this can actually be used. But AI is not going to be a fun, exciting, disruptive technology that empowers people. It's going to be a minor disruption that hurts people, that hurts jobs. And then it's going to become super mundane, like Google Assistant mundane. And it'll get way better, but it's going to sort of shrink into something that's kind of boring. And when it gets kind of boring, then we know that we've got the actual practical consumer application of this technology. So, sorry, that was another rambling tangent on Jon Stewart. His show is gone, and Apple is apparently very sensitive about one of their biggest markets. What might Jon Stewart say about China? Oh no, we'll sell fewer iPhones in China. So yeah, that's kind of a bummer. But I'm for as good of a commentator as he is, I really feel like Jon Stewart would just plain be happier as just a proper advocate. Like watching him show up to Congress to support the 9/11 workers. The first responders, all the people that were denied healthcare by our government because of their ability to do their job in the midst of a terrible catastrophe that befell our nation. And that decades after that, we were still dealing with the ramifications of this event in our culture and our society. And to see him show up on the steps and to confront policymakers and to speak truth to power, I feel like that's where he's most effective. If I don't see him on TV ever again, I would be really sad. But if I saw him in news, and I mean as like a host of a show, if I saw him in news clips contributing to these conversations, I think that's where he today would be most effective. And I think he himself, as a person, as a human being, would probably just be happier contributing to helping and supporting those people. So it's a dicey one because I spent so much of my political emergence sort of dialing into conversations and topics, and the humor of a Jon Stewart on The Daily Show really helped guide me into a direction for approaching some of these conversations. Not whether or not I always agreed with him, it's the process, it's the analysis, it's the consistency, it's the drawing of parallels and metaphors, and there's something about a comedian that can do that in a way where maybe a more traditional stuffed shirt commentator reading the teleprompter, Ron Burgundy style, can't approach the same kind of relationship with an audience. So, I don't even know. Dave Burns. Also, oh no, Sam Cedar, what a nightmare. I like Sam Cedar. I liked him on Air America. So Dave will occasionally send me Sam Cedar clips in my DMs, and I've been digging it. Again, Sam Cedar seems to be on a tear, especially after some of the other debate bros got real cranky about him trying to talk to them. They got real afraid of Sam Cedar. Oh no, what if he says something mean to me? All right, moving right along. I've got another Ars Technica here from Dan Gooden. Again, I've got to lead into all of these. We've been talking about things like the impoopification of YouTube. Right? Seeing so many, again, a major news topic this last week, another set of more aggressive crackdowns on people who are using ad blockers for YouTube. And we had to understand this was going to be an escalating arms race. There are new platforms that are trying to be front ends for video streaming. Lewis Rossman is trying to create a platform where creators and audience can more sort of more directly interact, where there's fewer gatekeepers in between them. Sounds like a really interesting project. My feelings on YouTube and Google in general, when it comes to ads, I appreciate people who contribute, who share content, who engage, who... Check out these pictures. Oh no, I said something with the G word and two pixels lit up on my desk. I really do appreciate because the effort matters. It's not just, I watched this thing and it got a view and so that's the end of our relationship. It's also a part of the conversation. I don't make videos, I don't write articles to be the final word. What I'm hoping is kicking off the beginnings of a conversation And that's often why my reviews are sort of staggered and staged out the way that they are. I look at my YouTube channel as every video I post is the first comment of a forum thread. And unfortunately, Google seems hellbent on making conversations on YouTube more and more difficult to follow. Like, it's really a mess, especially if you go through the mobile side, where your comments have now been squished in between ads and video and ads in the video. And then it's really a menu setting. So if you swipe it, you're looking at other stuff. It is so galling to be a part of this process and not have any control over it. And they're simplifying our ability to serve ads. They're simplifying it, which means we have fewer tools and fewer resources to craft the video advertising relationship that we want. I really do appreciate people who are paying for YouTube Premium and sitting through ads to watch my content to help support my channel. I can't get overly upset with people who choose to use ad blockers because I have no say in this relationship. I do not control the ads that are served on my channel. As we get into another season of political debate, I'm almost positive that whatever your political leanings are, Google is going to find the most painful ads to serve you, not because they think that they can contribute to your opinion or decision-making process, but because you being outraged and upset is better for YouTube. Just like on Facebook, you keep someone upset and afraid and angry, they will spend more time on your social media platform. They will make more money at the expense of your mental health. Same thing happened during the last presidential run. I couldn't go to YouTube without being swarmed with Trump and conservative ads. So all of those companies are spending money on advertising, and YouTube is purposely using the advertiser's revenue to serve ads to the viewers that will either upset them or just won't apply, so it's a pain point. In the most ridiculous way possible, YouTube has made allies of viewers and advertisers. Because if I'm scrolling through Instagram, which I don't do very often anymore, but when I am, every now and then I scroll by an Instagram ad and it's something I might be interested in. Facebook is actually trying to pair me because they hope I'll buy stuff and they get a cut. Like, what a shocking concept that you have every bit of behavioral data on me that you do. You could be serving me ads that contribute to the commerce, to the capitalism of this relationship. But that has not been YouTube, in my experience, for years. For me, and I think for a number of people in here who have maybe considered using ad blockers on YouTube, it has always just been a nagging pain point, something to skip over. There's not been an ad that I look at and go, oh, you know what? That's actually kind of cool. Let me check that out. And that is a fundamental problem that I have with YouTube, especially for Google being the search and behavioral data company that they are. And in light of YouTube making more money than it ever has in the platform's history, at the same time as they're adding more ads and increasing YouTube Premium subscription rates. So they're squeezing users and advertisers again, on top of already having been more successful than they ever have been in the history of the platform. They did it after they announced that they beat expectations. Oh, and now that we've made more money on YouTube and we beat those financial expectations in our last quarterly, now we're going to raise rates on YouTube Premium. So dumb. So I can't control that. But this also came up, and a buddy in the chat, Dave Burns, I don't know if he wants to comment in the chat about it, but he was scrolling on his phone, scrolling through Google stuff, and got another ad that was obviously a scam. About 2 months ago, maybe 3 months ago, I was scrolling through the Google News feed, and I use this increasingly less frequently because of this exact same problem. Scrolling through the Google News feed, and I see an ad for a company selling those big home crate batteries. You know, I've reviewed a few, like the Anker, you know, the 767. It's this humongous home battery, solar generator, whatever we want to call it. So I click on the link, and they're trying to sell these, they're selling these batteries at like 1/10 the listed MSRP. And you can go through the whole process of picking out the battery and putting in your shipping details and giving them credit card information. It is so obviously a scam, but it looks just like the official Anker website. It looks just like the outdoorsy kind of vibe that you would expect. I think they ripped off some of the photos from the Anker website. So there's no way that that's legit. And then I took a second and I looked up the actual URL, searched for the company, and nothing but scam showed up in my search results. This is a total scam. This company's scamming people. You know, please report them, blah, 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 blah. But that was an ad that was just populated in my feed, scrolling through my Google news feed. And again, I feel like Dave was recently sharing something like that too. So this is from Ars Technica, Dan Gooden. Google hosted malvertising leads to fake KeePass site that looks genuine. Google has been caught hosting a malicious ad so convincing that there's a decent chance it has managed to trick some of the more security-savvy users who encountered it. Looking at the ad, which masquerades as a pitch for the open-source password manager KeePass, there's no way to know that it's fake. It's on Google, after all, which claims to vet the ads it carries. Making the ruse all the more convincing, clicking on it leads to keypass.info, which, when viewed in an address bar, appears to be the genuine KeePass site. So you can put in all of your password information, you can give them money, it's great. Google made money on this, and there's a not insignificant quantity of people who were probably duped by that, harmed by it, and at some point, we've got to reconcile how we do business on the internet, how Google interacts with advertisers and platforms and services, and then also, what protections do we end users get? If someone put all that information into a KeePass clone and had their entire identity ripped off, and their credit cards leached, and their personal information stolen, what did they get? Like a free year of credit monitoring? Like what is justice when your life has been tipped upside down and likely someone who isn't as tech savvy enough to fully understand all the ramifications of how that happens. I'm not against an advertising economy, but now what's happening is we're trying to squeeze more and more and more blood from these stones that we're engaging in things that are irresponsible. And at the top of the food chain, if you've got a problem with an industry, you should be looking at the industry leaders. And when it comes to advertising, Google, right at the top. Then we also have to tag Facebook and Amazon and Apple. They're all entwined in our data. Oh, excuse me, and Microsoft. I almost let them off the hook. But it's really gross. And this is a perfect example. So, if you can support, like, for example, maybe every couple of months you chip a buck to my Patreon, that's great. You don't have to keep it all year long. Chip a buck, get through some of the Patreon exclusives, let it lapse, come back when you can. That's a bigger help to me than sitting through ads on YouTube videos, right? Those types of relationships, those types of interactions, so much more beneficial. To the point where, like, I've toyed with the idea a number of times of just turning off comments on YouTube. Like, if I can't sustain the conversation and the relationships and the interactions there, why should I keep trying, right? So if you end up using an ad blocker on my content, I understand. I get it. This is now an increasingly hostile market where we have to look out for our own interests and we have to protect our user data and we have to help our family and friends. If you can support in other ways and share and interact, or maybe if you have the means, financially contribute every now and then, that helps. That helps a lot. And it's always greatly appreciated. Why I do my ridiculous Juan doesn't have a soundboard fanfare of glory with finger guns whenever someone pops up on the Twitch and subscribes through Twitch. That's the kind of effort that really helps continue producing the content that I enjoy producing and hopefully you enjoy watching. So, I had this one posted. I don't think we need to spend a lot of time on it because I really want to get into the gadget chat. Netflix wants to be the Netflix of gaming. So they're going to be looking at testing on Google TV and Roku using your phone as a controller and streaming the game to your TV. So it should be interesting to see how that might go down. Netflix has the servers, and right now their game catalog is pretty healthy. It's a really good collection of mobile games with a few good arcadey console and PC ports in there too. So I know people keep kind of forgetting that Netflix and Netflix gaming exists, but it's one of the things that even in light of Netflix announcing price hikes, I might hold on to our bottom of the barrel no ads plan for a little bit longer, just because of the way that they've kind of expanded beyond just content to watch. I like some of the games on Netflix too, and I really like you know, not dealing with ads or microtransactions or anything like that. Like if I install a Netflix game, I feel pretty good that my daughter's just gonna play it. Oh, Ghost Starscream. But Juan, if you turn off comments on your videos, you must be hiding something about you. Yeah, how OnePlus told me what to say about the OnePlus Open because I didn't call my video a review in 2 days of software being functional on the OnePlus Open. I should have been able to make a full review. No, I mean, I would leave comments and contact and everywhere else. Like, yeah, you want to drop me a comment on the Patreon? That's where I look first. It's literally where I'm looking to engage first. You can also drop me a comment on somegadgetguy.com. So, we've got a few interesting things that are going to be coming up for the tech industry. It broke this morning. I haven't really read up on it too much, but it looks like there have been some leaks on the Xiaomi 14 series that they might be getting a Chinese release, or excuse me, a Chinese announcement. I don't know if they'll be shipping or released yet, but they're looking to already be talking about the 14 series of Xiaomi phones. I want to say, was it October 26th that they might be doing some kind of keynote? Someone knows, and I looked at the article when I was still half asleep this morning. So we have to believe that in that lineup of phones, and also I would imagine Oppo and the BBK brands and Vivo are likely looking at accelerating some of this conversation too to beat Samsung to the punch. It means we're going to be getting our first looks at the Qualcomm Snapdragon 8 Gen 3 and the MediaTek Dimensity 9300. And if you'll pardon just a minute, I've got two articles here. One's by MS Power User and the other's from GSM Arena to nerd out on the silicon industry as we see how these chips are changing and evolving. This could be one of the biggest departures in chip design that we've ever seen from these two companies. Because of the way that we put out ARM reference designs, for the last several years, a MediaTek combination of CPU cores and a Qualcomm combination of CPU cores have been pretty similar at similar tiers of the market. You can almost always count on a slight price competition from MediaTek, but similar, right? They've been pretty comparable, especially with the Dimensity 9000. Well, I'm going to take a little sip of coffee here because I also have to burp. I just got that, Dave. Come on, guys. We know it's been Juan Plus for years now. Shill. Oh, Flowtech Wolf. Ask that question later on. I will absolutely dig into that question, Flowtech. But I'm kind of in a flow. All right. So, MS Power User. Let's kick them up first. Exclusive. Here is Qualcomm's new Snapdragon 8 Gen 3 full specs. So this is the chip that's going to be in our next series of phones. They don't really have a ton of information, but we do have this slide right here. Let me see if I can make this a little bit bigger. That helps. That actually looks so. MS Power User breaking down, you know, the new. They lead, of course, with the new AI components, the NPU. You know, the billion, 10 billion plus parameters, AI stock, PyTorch, ExecuTorch delegate, and fully optimized models. I need to really learn more about AI speak because none of that made any sense. But it is going to be built on a 4-nanometer process. So this isn't going to be the bleedingest bleeding edge of, say, TSMC's fabrication technology, where Apple and MediaTek are starting to occupy more of their 3-nanometer tech. But, you know, they're talking about their cryo CPU cores in a 1-to-5-to-2 configuration. So for the longest time, what we've been doing is octa-core, 4 big, 4 little. The little cores handle just sort of like those daily little interactions, and those big cores fire up when you need a little bit more compute power. Then around the Snapdragon 855, I want to say, what we started doing was 4 big, 4 little, but one of the big cores was clocked higher. So one of the big cores was, I mean, it's the same 4 cores, but one of them was boosted just to be a little bit faster. Then once we started getting into the 888, we took that even a step further by making one really big core backed up by 3 big, now technically medium-sized cores, and then we would have the 4 little power-efficient cores. This is getting silly, I know. Bear with me. Tensor was a different. It was 2 big, 2 medium, 4 small. And then we started moving cores out. So for the Snapdragon 8 Gen 2, it was 1 big, 4 medium, and 3 small cores. Still octa-core, but you had more compute power at the higher end of the performance place, and then fewer smaller little cores to handle the low power stuff. And that seems to be working pretty well. When you don't need a lot of compute power, you really don't need a lot of compute power. So if you sacrifice one of the little cores for one of the medium cores, then when you need all the performance of your phone, you've got 5 big, powerful cores ready to work. So now it looks like Qualcomm is going to take that a step further. It's 1 big core, 5 medium cores, and only 2 of the little power-efficient cores. This structure looks to be yet another step towards trying to maintain the edge. It's funny, we always talk about performance on mobile devices, and we just kind of put up synthetic benchmarks and AnTuTu scores, which I'm going to be doing here in just a sec. But when you look at how a phone really moves data around and how it crunches data, it is important to have a good score for the single core performance. But in my opinion, it's becoming increasingly more important that you've got a really good multi-core score. So every time someone hypes up like, oh, the new Apple A-series chip can, you know, has this huge Geekbench score, which is fine, but more of those heavy lifting apps are going to look at the entire compute platform of the chip. They're not just going to go through one CPU and say, oh, that's all I get. So increasingly that multi-core strategy matters for how we create these kinds of experiences, and we finish them more efficiently. Because also, if you have all this big, high-performance compute hardware in your phone, you'll accomplish the task faster, and in a weird way, you might end up using less battery life than if you had lower power chips working over a longer period of time. Okay, so that's Qualcomm. And I really thought we were going to see something similar from MediaTek. And boy howdy, it seems MediaTek is doing something completely different. And this is where stuff gets really exciting. So remember, Qualcomm was 1 big core, 5 medium-sized cores, and 2 little power-efficient cores. So an AnTuTu score tells you nothing about the real-world performance of a chip. The only thing an AnTuTu score tells you is how good the phone is at running AnTuTu. It's not going to tell you about long-term behavior. It's not going to tell you about workloads. It doesn't help you detail what specific tasks your phone will do better. So I've got to put that up there right now because I don't put much stock in this at all as being the killer descriptor, right? So a phone has a Dimensity 9300 and another phone has a Snapdragon 8 Gen 3, and I look at 2 AnTuTu scores, and that's not going to tell me anything at all about what phone I'll want to buy. The performance per watt matters way, way more. But that being said, the Dimensity 9300 has set a new record in Antutu, scoring over 2 million. And in part, because there are no little cores on the Dimensity 9300. So this is an octa-core processor. It is using the new 3-nanometer fabrication from TSMC, and it has 4 of the big cores and 4 of the medium cores. And GSM Arena is saying it's likely in a 1-3-4 configuration, which would be very similar to like the classic days of the 855 and the 865. So 4 really big X4 cores, but one of them is clocked a little higher, and then the other 3 are sort of more managed. And then 4 of what were previously the medium-sized cores, the Cortex A720s. So those are now the little cores. The A720s are more powerful than the big core that we used to have in the Snapdragon 888. So it's like you've got 4 of the most performant cores from a Snapdragon from 2 years ago as your little cores, as your little power devices, which could be amazing, or this chip could run so hot that it immediately throttles. Like, being able to get an Antutu score, chase the bigger benchmark, that doesn't actually help us get a better, higher performance phone. But seeing quad X4s with quad A720s is a bold move. And when we think about, well, what's the difference? You know, like, man, how can they fit all this or all those transistors? There's a 25% size reduction going from a 4-nanometer process to a 3-nanometer process. So if the Snapdragon 8 Gen 3 is really being fabbed at 4 nanometers and the Dimensity 9300 is being fabbed at 3 nanometers, and we get the more advanced FinFET tech from TSMC, or let's say Qualcomm struggles with some of their batch being made by Samsung, that could bring us the power efficiency we need to just install bigger compute units. Maybe that's enough to scale the differences between those two production fabrication technologies. So I'm not going to be able to make it to the Qualcomm summit, but I think I am going to try and track down. We'll see if there are any openings or if there's any opportunity to talk to people from MediaTek, because after Qualcomm does their summit, we can be sure MediaTek is going to have some kind of an event to share what they're going to be working on too. And if I can't, or even if I can, I'm really going to try and reach out to Dr. Ian Cutress and to see if we could have a chat. Like, in your experience, like, what do these different technologies, like, what does that really bring to the table, or how is that really manifested in real world use? Because this to me is fascinating. If we've got a Dimensity 9300 in this 4x4 or 1-3-4 configuration, we could be looking at phones that are nearly as powerful as last generation Intel Core i5 laptops, but still staying under 10 watts of power. Which, if that doesn't mean anything to you and it's all gobbledygook, think about a last generation mainstream consumer laptop that can run on a phone battery significantly longer than that laptop could run out in the field and do a similar amount of work. It's like saying, I have this little fuel efficient engine in my Nissan, but now I've shrunk the engine so it's even more efficient, and I can do just as much work as like a really nice inline six. So I've got a 6-cylinder that does like, you know, 280 horsepower, but now I've shrunk my little Nissan 4-cylinder and it can do the same, but it sips gas. It's just as performant as that inline six, but I'm still getting 45 miles to the gallon. And I'm sure if I bring that up with Dr. Ian Cutress, he's going to roll his eyes at me and go like, yeah, it's kind of like that, I guess. Oh, Rick22BR, Antutu helps tell you what phone you don't want to buy? if you use AnTuTu in any way for managing a performance per dollar, performance per watt, then you miss out on really some of the interesting things. Like a pixel is always going to lose the Geekbench race, right? Pixels turn in terrible results on things like AnTuTu. Yet, for the humongous disparity in AnTuTu scores, pixels are typically some of the fastest at manipulating image data. So if you want to chew up video, like say you want to edit out a little like family video clip or share some stuff on TikTok or Reels or YouTube Shorts, then if it matters to you that you're doing that work faster and that it's finishing this stuff faster, then yeah, pixels become a much more interesting option, even though they've got the lower AnTuTu score. So even if you're using AnTuTu as a way to cull phones from your shopping selection, you might be missing the absolute best phone for your performance needs, because AnTuTu isn't really telling you what the phone does better. None of these scores translate into consistent differences for real-world tasks. And often it's stuff like file compression. I know people keep like rolling their eyes whenever I bring up stuff like file compression, but think about all the times that you need to manage information on constricted pipes up to the internet, pull that back down. Are you on Wi-Fi or are you on a mobile plan? You need to squish a photo before you send it. You need to, when you edit a video clip, you want to reduce the file size. You can also reduce the bit rate. There's so many of these little aspects of things like file compression that matter. So if that matters to you, well, a pixel can outperform a Dimensity 9200 when it comes to file compression. That's actually the Dimensity's weakness right now, is squishing file sizes down. So if that type of in-the-moment communication over mobile networks is important to you buying a phone, wouldn't you want the phone that does that more efficiently? Because it's going to result in faster processing times, less battery wear, and improved file transmission. So it's that kind of stuff. Like if you're just looking at the big number and you think, oh, cool, it's got the bigger number, I'm safe, you might be buying a phone that is not good for what you want it to do, but it had the bigger score. So Dr. Claw, I'm hoping, you know, with that kind of performance per watt, throttling becomes even more unnecessary. Man, I'm hoping, I hope we've learned our lessons from the Snapdragon 8 Gen 1, that not only do you have this extremely high performance chip, but that the phone manufacturers build their phones around the chip to properly cool it. Because I'll go back. I have a bunch of, you know, 8 Gen 1 phones that I really like. I love the Motorola. I love my Vivo X80 Pro. But man, you use them for any length of time and you'll go Hot Pocket. You know, there, something will happen where the radio's going, it's crunching data in the background, you're getting notifications, and you can feel your thigh is getting uncomfortably warm. And that does not happen with the 8 Gen 2 or the 8 Plus Gen 1. It's just so much easier to just manage and let it be a part of the background of your day, and you get better battery life to boot. Yeah. Oh, yeah, Dr. Claw. And poo-poo, I like that. That's a good poop pun for the impoopification of the internet. And poo-poo really didn't tell you what a beast the Snapdragon 765 was, for example, which is still one of the best mainstream consumer chips that has ever been released. So that catches us up, man. That's all of the tech news and articles and stuff. This is like the fastest I've ever chewed through news blocks and stuff like that. As we transition over to talking about gadgets and phones, and I hope, I know that someone asked a really great question about kids and phones. We can definitely touch on that too. I would just like to highlight that in May, we had Google I.O. And during Google I.O., Google announced that they were opening up the Find My Device service. And it was going to become more of a location tracking service, kind of like Apple AirTags. And they announced partnerships with Chipolo and Pebblebee. Tile is considered to be a part of that conversation also, although I still haven't gotten any direct confirmation from reaching out to people at Tile, whether or not they're going to contribute, or if it's going to be like, if you use our app in conjunction with, or if it's going to be something weird like that. May. Devices, I have had pre-orders on trackers from Chipolo and Pebble Bee since the end of May. We are now at the end of October. We're getting into the last week of Techtober. I still do not have location trackers and an expanded Find My Device network from Google. How dare Google? Way to fail us, Google. Google just can't do anything right. I mean, what's the holdup? Well, you see, Google reached out to Apple. And Google said, hey, this is like Mr. Google and Mr. Apple, because, right, they're just two big people, corporations, and money is speech, right? Corporations are people. So Mr. Google goes to Mr. Apple and says, hey, you released these AirTags, and this is like throwing a hand grenade into the location privacy conversation. You've delivered at scale a product that harms people on older iOS devices and people with Android devices. Over 50% of the population of smartphone and mobile gadget consumer audiences. And Apple went, what are you going to do about it? We're Apple. So Mr. Google says, okay, we're going to fix our side of this for you. So instead of this weak sauce app that Apple came up with where you had to manually scan, I wonder if I'm being tracked by an AirTag right now. Oh, I'll push this button on the Apple app and scan for my location and give all this location and data and metrics to Apple and finding whether or not I'm being tracked. Because that's something we all do on the regular, right? We all manually look around in our lives to see if someone is abusing location tracking hardware. So Google built into Android through built into Android through these security patches, the Google Play system updates, that now we've got the ability, or more phones, more current phones, have the ability to passively scan around us to see if a Bluetooth location tracker, not necessarily an AirTag, but anything that's operating on Bluetooth, is in our general vicinity. So then Mr. Google says, hey, we've got the solution. We fixed it. We've employed it, and we've pushed it to Android devices. And especially as more phones are getting updated and we get more of these Play system updates out there, we're feeling better about making sure that people can stay safe around your terrible product, Mr. Apple. And so now, the flip side of this is, if Google wants to deliver a Find My network at scale, Apple has to employ a similar mechanic. Because if Google just puts out a bunch of trackers, Bluetooth location trackers, immediately the Apple tech journalists are gonna complain about the horrific privacy violations from Google. Google didn't put any safety into this product at all. And now, if you have an iPhone and someone puts a Google tracker on you, they can track your location. And there are so many more Android devices out there, it's gonna be even more accurate to how your location is being tracked. And Google is just terrible, and they're the worst, and they're doing all this bad stuff, and Google steals your data and sells your data, and it's going to be a nightmare. So Google has put this entire thing on hold since May. I have pre-orders with Chipolo and Pebble Bee. Got emails from both of them. We have to put it on hold. And now we're into October. From May to October, with no word, no notification, no roadmap, nothing, no commentary from Apple as to when they'll finally get around to updating the iPhone to also be able to locate these trackers. So I have filed a complaint with the FTC. It's an anti-competitive business practice. Apple made this problem. Apple is stalling the solution to this problem. And while Apple is stalling the solution to this problem, they get to profit from the mess that they've made in selling one of the only tracker networks that can operate at the scale of Apple's Find My Phone network. I would humbly request that people also go and check out the FTC's website, where you can file grievances for what you believe are anti-competitive business practices, and maybe just shoot them a little letter. I mean, my letter isn't like the most amazing piece of writing or legalese or anything like that. I broke down the timeline of events. I mentioned Apple's security issues all of the problems that we've seen with state attorney generals looking into how air tags can be abused. Also, how law enforcement has been utilizing modified air tags. We had a couple stories about that not too long ago. And I sent that to them, and I'm never going to get a direct reply from the FTC in their business anti-competition division. But that's also part of the purview of the FTC. And I feel we have a legitimate claim. Not that Apple needs to immediately fix this issue, but just Apple needs to disclose when they're going to roadmap this update for the iPhone. Because it predates iOS 17. It was a problem on iOS 16. And it actually makes the iPhone less secure as a platform. Again, Apple has managed to make everyone else look like they're the problem, but this is a problem of their making, and it makes their own customers less safe. It's like, again, I'm holding up other trackers, right? So if someone wants to try and do something, I mean, the Tile network, not nearly as good as Apple's AirTags, but I could modify this piece of hardware, probably swap out the battery and then disable the little speaker, stick it to someone's car, and an iPhone owner would never know. Because Apple wants to profit from the problem that they made for as long as they possibly can with no practical competition in the market. And that's a problem. And we should be upset about that. We should be really upset about that. So again, FTC.gov. This is a really cool resource, actually, where you can talk to regulators directly as a citizen of the United States and say, like, hey, I think this is a problem. Will they get back to you? Probably not. But if more of these complaints are delivered at scale, what we should be asking for is some type of public roadmap or public estimation of when Apple is going to make this update available, so that then those of us on the other side of this equation can start planning for how we might want to use other products and services. So that's the last little bit of soapboxing. And who wants to talk about fun phones? I have a Pixel 8 Pro. I don't have any Pixel location trackers for it. That'd be pretty sweet, right? Wouldn't it be cool if you could just have like a Google tracker and you could hook it up with your Pixel phone? Boy, that sure would be neat. I bet people would really like that if they could buy one.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Do you like podcasts about tech?
Oh, yeah.
Do you like podcasts about tech where you... See, I already it up. That's okay, because I don't want to stop the recording because then we got to redo it all. So I'll just put it apart. Do you like podcasts?
Yeah.
Do you like podcasts about tech?
Hell yeah.
Do you like podcasts about tech that have your favorite creators like Juan Carlos Bagnell, TK Bay, and many, many more?
Oh, yeah.
Well, if you do, you should check out the Nomad Tech Project with Sam and Joe. It's a podcast about everything tech and sport and food and getting to know your favorite creators from the back end. Like, you know, you could watch their podcast and hear what they have to say about tech, but where did they go to high school? What did they like to do before they became a podcaster or a tech creator or a YouTuber or a Twitch streamer? Check us out. We're on every Sunday from 3 p.m. Central, 9 p.m. BST in the UK.
Ish.
We'd love to have you. Maybe throw a sub and tell your friends about it. Again, Nomad Tech Project with Sam and Joe on your favorite podcast aggregators. Take care. Love your faces. Be excellent to each other. We'll see you on the show.
Goodbye.
Oh, you guys, Aditya Anil won for FCC chair in 2024. So I just want to make sure that we understand, though, that this is an FTC complaint. So you go to FTC.gov, not FCC.gov. But the FTC has an anti-competitive business practice division. So there you go. Excuse me. I thought I caught the main burp when I had the mic muted. So I want to start with the Pixel 8 Pro. My experiences have been very positive. I have the performance benchmarks on patreon.com/somegadgetguy. Like, I'm important, but you know. From Zaza5555, what's the update that they're holding back? Apple is holding back a notification alert update. So on Android phones, Our phones will scan for Bluetooth devices that track location, and if one is in our proximity for an extended period of time, we get an alert. Apple needs to do the same, and they're not pushing that update out to iPhones, and this is a problem for iOS owners. Again, Apple is not contributing to the Bluetooth special interest group. The Bluetooth SIG defines all of the parameters of all the myriad numbers of ways that you can use Bluetooth, and Apple is not contributing to that. Apple is using all of their data to put Bluetooth into their phones, and then they're coming up with proprietary solutions to sell products to their own customers at the expense of everybody else. And I feel if Apple can't contribute to the Bluetooth SIG, then they should not be allowed to use Bluetooth. But they should have been defining tracker location as a part of the Bluetooth spec, and then we wouldn't have to do this dance of, oh, did you get an update for your phone? Oh, I guess it can scan. So, Pixel 8 Pro. Performance benchmarks, patreon.com/somegadgetguy. I'm of two minds on talking about performance. First of all, I think you all have heard me say this a number of times in the past, but I feel the original version of what we wanted from Google on Tensor 1 was probably designed for the Pixel 5, and they couldn't make it to market in a reasonable fashion. So what we got for the Pixel 5 was really a Pixel 5a with a couple upgraded components, and then the Pixel 5a 5g was really what would have been a Pixel 5a Plus or a Pixel 5a XL or whatever we want to call it. And then with the Pixel 6, that's where we got Tensor. So I feel like Tensor, from a traditional CPU-GPU conversation, Tensor's performance is likely always going to be just a little bit less than a year behind Snapdragons and MediaTek's. We've got to see the iterations now start to catch up with the market, but it can't just leap there all in one generation. So Tensor is a more traditional configuration this year, but we're still looking at performance that in a straight-up race on batch photo processing, right? We're still looking at performance that compares a little bit closer to phones from last year or the transition between last year and the year before. So that's a part of it. Immediately, I'm going to say that one of the major aspects of where those performance differences might get in the way, where people might feel it, is in gaming. A Tensor 3 can play games well, but it is not my top pick for a gaming option. Like, if gaming on your phone is a primary consideration, and I know people like to roll their eyes at that, but you can play some really awesome games on your phone. We mentioned Netflix for gaming. You want to play Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles? You can play it on your phone. If you have Netflix, you can play it for free. Or you paid for it, but, you know, you can install it without paying additional monies. Not great. Not great. And it can struggle in some really graphics-intense titles just because of the optimization and the drivers and whether or not the developers are looking at different GPUs. I put it head-to-head against my... Where is it? Oh, it's over here. I put it head-to-head against my LG V50 with a Snapdragon 855. So this is a four-year-old phone, 2019. In the first intro walk around, get acquainted and up to speed of a game like Alien Isolation, the LG V50 was maintaining better frame rates than the Tensor 3 and the Pixel 8 Pro. If you want to play games on your phone, I have to say that the Tensors are not top picks for me right now. Where I am happy to see, and we talked about this a little on Best of Our Week, where TK and I were also breaking down both of these phones. I am happy to see that there have been some improvements to thermal performance. The phones aren't running quite as aggressively. So when I say aggressively, I don't mean that they're so hot to the touch you can't use them. What I mean is they get hotter faster than I was expecting. The Tensor 2 and the Pixel 7 Pro, you'd start using something on the phone, then you'd immediately run into a little bit of a block. We actually had this issue. I was on stream, and I picked up, because I was also talking about the Xiaomi, the 13T Pro. So I was showing on my Pixel 7 Pro, I took it off the wireless charger that I have here on my desk that I have now since unplugged because it runs stupid hot. It's concerningly warm. So I pulled the Pixel 7 Pro off and I was like, hey, I just want to show you when I take a couple photos and I go pop, pop, and then the shutter grayed out. I got two photos before the phone was too hot to keep processing information in the background. It's those kinds of startling thermal issues that I feel we've improved upon with the Pixel 8 Pro. If you run the Pixel 8 Pro hard and you've got the 5G radio cooking and you're using this really beautiful bright display and you're kind of keeping all of that cranked, yeah, the phone is going to run hot. It's going to give you some thermal warnings. All phones will eventually reach some kind of limit. The limits on the Pixel 8 Pro are improved over the limits on the Pixel 7 Pro. And what you can't ever fault Google is really, really good capturing that one moment camera performance. It's the pull phone out of pocket, push shutter, put phone back in. I don't think anyone does it better than a Pixel. I really don't. I like to show more advanced photography aspects where I think we can do this here. So this hasn't been on the charger. It's not running warm, but it's in my case here. Oh, and do I have the... Yeah, the 13T Pro is on. So I can immediately back-to-back this. So here's the main camera, and I'm just going to kind of keep hitting the shutter until let's see when the buffer fills, and it's starting to struggle to finish the photos that are in the buffer. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 11. 16. 22. So it starts doing a thing where you go to hit the button and it actually kind of borks that one photo. So you can't just go pop, 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 pop. Because hitting that as fast as I just was, you could see it was really only flashing the screen every other shutter press. And when you slow it down a little bit and you do that, you get about four in a row and then it borks one, about three in a row and it borks one. And it's still working on all of these photos in the background. There's so much computational post-processing. You can fill this phone up really quickly. Now, if you don't, if you're okay with having a less image finished photo, but you know, you still want some pretty HDR, let me get this on right now. So this is my Xiaomi 13T Pro and open the camera. So same thing, and we've got HDR on. So this is doing image processing. It's doing the Leica Authentic image processing. That is applying a certain kind of filter, a kind of look. It finishes the photo with certain exposure values, and then it will add like slight vignetting to the corners of the frame to make it look more like film and an old school camera lens. And I'm gonna try and go as fast as I was where the Pixel was borking every other shot. So if I go pop, 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 I can just kind of keep going because it's not crunching as much data in the background to finish off each photo. It's not stacking as many DNG files, but it's still doing an HDR processed image. Like I'm going to go through this here and it's almost done with a lot of them. Let me get into the gallery. So all of these look the same. On older phones, when we would do HDR like that, you'd see one that was kind of HDR-fied, and then all of the follow-up photos would look standard, you know, just like a regular raw image processed into a JPEG. But that doesn't happen here on the Xiaomi. You can see I've done this run a couple times. I've just got like hundreds of photos of my bookshelf from shooting blind on the Xiaomi 13T Pro. So it's those kinds of things where I've heard some criticisms like, oh, if I have an iPhone 15 Pro, look, I can just keep shoot, 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 and it's so much faster. And yeah, that's true. If you like the Google photo processing though, Pixel's gonna do it for you. And maybe you didn't need to take 20 photos to get that shot if you got it right from the Pixel 8 Pro just going out, push the button once and putting it back in your pocket. I trust the Pixel a lot more in those kinds of singular photo experiences. The other thing that I do want to talk about DTNL, you just did 7.5 gigabytes of random HDR shots off the shelf. More than that, man. Because I have raw capture going on both of these phones right now, too. I've got to make sure they don't upload to my Google Photos with those raw files, because that would be awful. The other thing that's also been... I've really appreciated about this year of Pixel design. This is the first Pixel... Well, no, I guess, like... The Pixel 5 was kind of okay for this, too. So, okay, from the Pixel 6 Pro and the Pixel 7 Pro, I'm so happy to be back on a flatter screen just because I could get a regular, cheap glass screen protector. I really like the work of the folks over at Whitestone Dome. They do the screen protector kit where you drop this, like, gel, and then you put the glass on top of the gel, and then a UV lamp cures the gel, so it's the most, like, light-transmissive experience that you can have. But it was really nice spending $8 and getting a 3-pack of glass screen protectors that fit fine, just sticking it on the screen without having to do anything fancy. And I really hope we're done with this aesthetic experiment of bending the edges of an OLED over the corners of a phone. Because at the same time, the other thing that's a major improvement here on the Pixel 8 Pro is I'm using a Peak Design case. So the Peak Design case adds even flatter sides to really hold on to this phone when you're using it like a camera. And Peak Design has their own magnetic mount that also works with their tripods. You just stick it right onto a nice tripod, little magnetic clamp. You can add it to your bike's handlebars or your motorcycle, or you can get an in-dash mount for your car. And it's really nice. But this year, new for this year, is they've also introduced colors. So while my Pixel 7 Pro had this really nice kind of fabric case, charcoal with black accents, that's really nice. It feels a little like the classic fabric cases on Pixels. I really like that now my Pixel 8 Pro is a color that stands out better. They don't have bay blue. My Pixel is bay blue. You would never know that it was bay blue because I've got it in this big chunky case, but at least it's not gray and black. I like that a lot. So I have to throw the kudos. This podcast not sponsored by Peak Design, but I'm a big nerd. I mean, I have a Peak Design bag over here, and I've got my Peak Design portable tripod over there. And do I have it out still? Oh, I think I put that away. Yeah, I put it back in the box. But I have the Peak Design tripod mount for this case style. So often, especially with the premium photography, like Moment, right? Moment camera lenses. You get these really fun clip-on lenses for iPhones. They give you some token support for Samsungs, and then everyone else, they don't care. I really have to throw the thank you to Peak Design for starting with the Pixel 6 and continuing to support Google's in their lineup of cases. So they have to make cases and get them shipped and sorted and put into packaging. And you know that Google is not going to sell as many Pixel phones as Samsung will sell Galaxy phones. So it's kind of a big deal when we get one of those more premium photography accessory brands to consider phones that are a little less popular. If I could get that Peak Design experience on my Xiaomi 13 Ultra, I would be so happy. It would be so nice. So the case isn't cheap, but when I say it was 45, something like that. But I was happy to actually just buy it. And I didn't ask for a review unit. Like I said, none of this is sponsored. This is just me putting my money where my mouth is. But that's actually been the really fun thing on the Pixel 8 Pro. The Pixel 7 and the Pixel 6, actually I have both the Pixel 7 and the Pixel 6, are in there. I bought Peak Design cases. But these needed Whitestone Dome screen protectors to account for the curved glass on the sides. Protecting the Pixel 8 has been a little bit easier. And I really hope that that's where we're going from here on. I'm good if we give up on curved glass, which contributes almost nothing except to make the fingers feel like the phone is a little bit skinnier and a little bit thinner. And I get why some people like that. But for me, it's more about practicality. And I want a more practical device to run after my now 8-year-old daughter, shoot photos and take videos. We went to... I've got to scan through all these photos of my bookshelf now. We went to the Discovery Cube here in Los Angeles, and I got to like kind of let me turn the speakers off. So let me just kind of rewind this here for just a second. I tried to pull off my best The Shining in the hay maze as my daughter went through this little kid hay maze, and the video, well, it's blown out here. Let me see if I can just reduce the screen brightness a little. That look a little bit better. You're going to catch glare off my lights. But, you know, I'm running around trying to shoot this 4K 60 video, and I need to know I've got a good grip on my phone, and it looks so good. It looks so cool. It looks like, you know, the hedges of The Shining, only without setting up like a Steadicam rig or a gimbal. And a part of that is because I can just grip appropriately, tuck my elbows to the side of my body, and I'm just kind of floating with her, like from my torso to shoot this video. Stuff like that. That it matters more to me that I can do that, do it easily, trust that I'm not going to drop my phone on uneven, sandy, rocky ground, and end up with a really cool looking video at the end of all that. I feel more comfortable using the phone like that without having to add other accessories, gimbals, tripods, mounts, brackets, all that stuff. I did it just from holding the phone case. So Baseball Super, this is kind of what I'm talking about. Curve is not just aesthetic. It allows a larger width of screen without excessive bezel. The screen width downgrade is one of the reasons I stuck with the Pixel 7 Pro. So let's look at that. I've got a Pixel 7 Pro. And I've got a Pixel 8 Pro. And I'm going to put them sort of side by side. And I don't know if you'll be able to see this, but my fingertips can barely feel a difference between the Pixel 8 and the Pixel 7 Pro. So curving the edges of this, you're not wrong. It helps minimize the bezel, but it just moved the bezel to the sides of the phone, right? So it looks a little thinner. But the actual manufacturing of how they shrunk the rest of the phone, in fact, like, I almost want to say, if I set these flat, I almost want to say the Pixel 7 is wider than the Pixel 8. But that could just be my fingers playing a trick on me because of how this measures out. Yeah, I don't know, man. I'm not feeling like this is such a structural or architectural difference. And instead of having anything that's at the borders of your screen be harder to interact with because the screen is curved. Like, for example, when you have menus that slide side to side in Google Play. Part of the thing that kind of sucks about using Google Play when the phone uses a swipe from the side as a back action is whenever you've got something that scrolls, you've got to be very deliberate about scrolling from the middle. But if you're holding it and you're trying to one thumb scroll, on a curved screen, it is more likely that you're going to hit the back gesture and get out of that page. We're all splitting hairs here, right? That is a very fine, detailed difference in performance between a flat panel screen and a curved screen that one will probably be more likely until someone really gets a feel for how they're supposed to hold the phone with curved glass on the sides. But at the same time, I'm not hurting to reach things on the Pixel 8 Pro where I was fine using the Pixel 7 Pro. And so now I don't have any distortion at the edges of the screen. I like to do my turn-by-turn navigation in my car in landscape, so now I don't have a strip of refracted light from the curved display at the top of my screen. Media looks better, especially when it does fill this aspect ratio, because I don't have a bending happening at the top of the frame. The only thing I can kind of point to is that it looks a little cooler when the sides of your screen are curved. But that's a more expensive manufacturing process that makes the front of your phone more fragile and doesn't really contribute much to the operation of the device. And that's also where it kind of runs into things like, let me pull up LumaFusion. And when you go to do a render, see, like, you've got controls immediately to the edge of the bezel. And tapping on those is a multi-tap on the Pixel 7 Pro, because you've got to line up on the curve, on the edge of where that lives, because I don't feel like LumaFusion should have to redesign their app for the phones that are going to have curves and say, oh, well, we'll just give you a strip in the middle that you can interact with, and we'll add digital bezel to the sides of your screen. And I know that people say, well, but most people don't do things like it's the same. But look, I mean, like, I've got every single one of these controls is right on the bezel. If you alter any of this in LumaFusion, you are fighting the curve, and you've got to be very deliberate about where you press. So I don't miss curves. Again, there has been so little that the curve of the phone has contributed to my experience. It's made other aspects more difficult, and it makes finding screen protectors and cases more expensive, and it makes the phones more fragile for the exposed glass on the areas where we should be holding the phone. I've never been a fan. I'm happy that this is going away. they're saying, oh, the aspect ratio is different. How different is the aspect ratio? That is a very good question. Let's go to thegsmarena.com. We're gonna do this live. We're gonna do the Pixel 8 Pro. And we're gonna say it's the difference between 19.5:9 to 20:9. And then we're gonna compare with the Pixel 7 Pro. So 6.7 inch. The Pixel 8 Pro is 20:9, and the Pixel 7 Pro is 19.5:9. So if we're going to say that a strip of, what is this? So it's 29.92. So it's a 100 pixel, it's the long ways. A 100 pixel difference is the difference between those phones. And what we arrive at is a slightly narrower phone with a flat screen. Is that what I'm seeing? Do they actually back that up? Let's see if my fingers were actually accurate here. So it's 162.6 by 76.5 and 8.8. So it's a teeny bit thinner. It's 0.1 millimeters skinnier than the Pixel 7 Pro. Apparently my fingers can detect a 0.1 millimeter difference in the width of a phone. I don't know about you guys, but I'm pretty tapped in. So yeah, it's the same people who were complaining like, oh, well, LG had an 18:9 and Samsung had a 19:9, and that's totally different. Or someone who's going to say, oh, Sony's are so skinny at 21:9. You should use a phone that's 20:9. The actual practical functional differences in that ratio, exceedingly small. And I cannot think of a single instance where going from 19.5:9 aspect ratio to 20:9 aspect ratio is going to have a fundamental impact on the operation of that device, except for giving me slightly better letterboxing on 21:9 cinema content. And we're talking about letterboxing of what? I can't do that math in my head. I want to say like 15 pixels on either side of your video window, and it's 15 pixels better on the Pixel 8 Pro. So not only is the screen not curved around the top and bottom of your video window, but it's giving you slightly less letterboxing than the Pixel 7 Pro. I mean, is that really what we're saying is an important aspect of phone reviewing? Because I'm telling you, I put either of these phones into people's hands, and that's going to be a non-issue. I mean, like, if we're really saying, like, well, who should we recommend this phone to, or what's this? And you say, like, oh, but it was such a critical feature to have bent OLEDs on the sides of the screen. I think the exploration of that is going to be, and is likely going to go in the favor of the flatter display. I feel like a lot of people are like, oh, that feels like looks really cool, or but what happens, or what do you do for a case, or any of the other questions, like what happens if it falls on its side? And people are going to go like, oh, well, maybe I don't want a phone with curved edges. So, yeah, Barry Johnson, but I said it, right? I said I felt like the Pixel 8 Pro was a little skinnier, Barry says. Juan's fingers are calibrated for 0.1 millimeter differences. But, like, I feel, okay, yeah, that's me probably being up my own rear a little there. The experiences on the Pixel 8 Pro have been really good. I feel like this is another step, and this is going to be mirrored in a video that I'm going to be coming out with soon, that this is a very good communicator phone. I think it's got a lot of challenges ahead of it for defining what a premium tier Android experience should resemble. And honestly, the main challenges aren't hardware performance. It's not CPU, GPU stuff. It's, are we really pushing the software to a point where Google can make this claim, hey, it's okay if we don't have the highest performance CPU in a phone. What we're looking at are assistant features and AI features and editing features, and if that's enough to really move the needle. Because Google has one advantage here where I'm almost positive that when we really put these things to the test in synthetic benchmarks, that an 8 Gen 3 and a Dimensity 9300 will outperform a Tensor 3 in computational MPU AI tasks. But none of the manufacturers who are going to use Qualcomm or MediaTek will have the same in-house software to hardware optimization that Google can bring to the table with the Pixel 8 Pro. So that to me is going to be the major talking point as we kick off the first half of 2024. Is, yeah, there's this phone. It's going to completely outperform a Tensor 3 until you really use it. It's going to win every showdown and every fight unless you use a real app that someone might have on their phone and not just look for a Geekbench score. So that's actually the place where I want to pivot. For part of my daughter's birthday celebrations and festivities, we went to the Pumpkin Patch, Tapia Brothers Farm. This podcast not sponsored by Tapia Bros. It's our tradition. Like, since she's been born, we have gone to do the kickoff of our Halloween celebration by buying some little mini pumpkins and taking Lex for a little pony ride. And we ate a grip of kettle corn. It's just what we always do. Apparently, yesterday was foldable day at Tapia Bros Farm. We were waiting in line to do a tractor ride. It takes you through like this little corn maze, and they have all these like scarecrows and stuff set up. It's like daylight, but little kid spooky. It's super adorable. And I'm standing in line, and I look two rows over, and there's a gentleman holding a Pixel Fold. And I'm like, whoa. I had to share this on social media. So again, it's two rows over, so I can't talk to this individual, but I had my OnePlus open with me, and I very sneakily, creeper style, shot a photo of him holding it. I really tried to make sure there was no other like personal identifying information, but I did get his Raiders t-shirt. So maybe someone could determine who it was from that. But I used the telephoto and then the 6X, and it looks like it's a pretty good shot. So I took that photo, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I got to share this. So I shared it on the Discord, and then I look back. His entire family was kitted out. So he was the grandfather. There was a dad who had a Pixel Fold. The mom had an iPhone 14 Pro Max. And then the son, who I want to say was mid to late teens, was using a Galaxy Z Fold. And I couldn't tell exactly which one. It looked like a Z Fold 4, but I couldn't quite tell. And we're like, oh my God, this family standing like right next to me here, that's like $8,000 worth of smartphone MSRP. But they were like in it. And everyone had the corresponding watch. So it was Pixel Fold to Pixel Watch. iPhone to Apple Watch and Samsung to Galaxy Watch. It was like each one was fronting their own platform. Like, this is my ecosystem. I've got a Galaxy Watch. It was awesome. But walking around the whole day, I saw a grip of Pixels. Like, traditional, like, Pixel 6s especially were really popular out at the farm. And then I saw a couple Z Flips, and I saw a couple other Z Folds. And again, I want to say older, but it's hard to tell once you're looking at people. Like, especially that really bulky case is kind of the giveaway for, like, a Z Fold 3 and a Z Fold 4 when we started looking at the differences in those designs. But I was walking around with my OnePlus Open. I had a terrifying experience using this out at a farm, dodging hay bales, trying not to trip on little kids. It's dirty, sandy, rocky ground all around you. If it drops, you know you're going to do some kind of damage. And I wasn't opening it very often, but I did do one selfie. Like, when we got on the tractor ride, I had to do a big group selfie, and we were sharing a little tractor car with another family who, the mom had a Pixel 6. And so we got into a whole conversation like, oh, what did your phone just do? And it folds in half. And you're like, oh, you know what's cool is you've got the Pixel 6. I just started using the Pixel 8 Pro. And I pull a Pixel 8 Pro out of my pocket. And she's like, oh, I love the cameras. And I was like, oh, yeah, it's so cool. So the OnePlus Open, I think, has been my fastest onboarding to trusting a phone out in the field to be a regular phone. I got real gun-shy with the Pixel Fold because of the early commentary about the display trench. So on the Pixel Fold, there is a pretty sizable gap between the screen protector and the bezel of the phone. But over time, you know, I put an outer screen protector on it. I still have to keep shouting out Michael Peppertech for cluing me into the company that makes the panel case for the Pixel Fold. This has been a great case. I love it. And it was cheap. It was like an $8 case for a foldable phone. But it took me a long time to get comfortable really feeling like, okay, I can take this phone out and I can use it like this. This is a situation where I feel safe opening it and then using it as a tablet. But then I'm constantly like doing a once-over before I close it to make sure nothing's in that screen protector trench. I eventually took the Pixel Fold on a road trip, which you can read about my experiences on somegadgetguy.com, but I want to say it was about a month of like, let me take it out for a little bit here, let me do something with it there, and then I really felt like, okay, this is how I can rely on this like a more traditional phone. I don't know what it is about the OnePlus Open. A part of it is it came with its own bumper case. So little plastic hard panels that clip onto the front and back. In part because of the Pixel Fold, but also because of just the form factor and the weight, I feel like I've gotten up to speed on the OnePlus Open a little faster than I did on the Pixel Fold. So this has been kind of an eye-opening experience in what else we can do with a phone, how we can turn it into more of a computer, how it can sort of displace other gadgets, and not the least of which is just my excitement that it has video output so that I can use it in a bunch of those other situations. So I remember, Bray Gray, I love Juan's tech encounter reenactments. Well, but it's the superpower that we have. And I feel like we can use that superpower for the forces of awesome more often. So here's this mom and a dad, and they've got these adorable twin girls, and I've got my daughter, and she's wearing like a birthday button, and there's this fun little conversation. It's a single-serving friendship, just as we're driving around a farm. And it felt real good making that mom feel good about her phone. That was awesome. And I mean, it wasn't like I was just kind of pandering, like, oh, you've got a Pixel, and that's a Google, and that's really good. But it was like sharing that experience of like, the photos are really good. I know the photos are really good. You've got two little daughters, and they're running around. I know, it takes great photos. And that was just a really nice experience. Billy Quizboy reminding me, I need to answer that earlier question about the right age to get a kid their first cell phone. Who was it? It was Wolf? Something Wolf? I can't remember who asked the question, and I know we're getting sort of to the end of this podcast here. And also, if there are other questions about the OnePlus Open, send them my way, because a lot of people seem to think that they have opinions about the OnePlus Open in my YouTube comments, and it's very clear that they have no idea what OnePlus has been up to since, like, the OnePlus 6. Lots of people love saying, oh, but it needs to be cheaper. The original OnePlus was like $200 and a half a ham sandwich. So OnePlus can't sell expensive phones now because they used to only be fire sale cheaper. If it was cheaper, it would be worth it because I'm good at tech. I'm a tech enthusiast.
The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by Me Audio. So here's the deal. If you've ever seen me in a live stream or in an interview or some other kind of video, you've probably seen me wearing some fancy earbuds. For the last couple years, my work buds have been almost exclusively from Me Audio. Excellent drivers, fantastic accessories, and both my wife and I had our ears scanned by the folks at Me Audio for custom molded ear tips. Super comfy. The MX line of Pro in-ear monitors is one of the easiest lineups to understand, starting at $60 and built around actual professional use. Detailed sound and durable construction, but also with some fun options like customizable faceplates. Even if you're not working on stage or in studio, Pro solutions like these are fantastic audio options, and they don't need to break the bank. And the company also supports a lineup of consumer gear with options for true wireless and noise-canceling Bluetooth earbuds, adapters for TVs to stream your audio to nicer headphones, and headsets for kids to help control the volume on fresh, developing ears. I can't stress that last one enough. We have to start kids out with healthier listening habits. It's a great combo, high-quality audio gear built by a team of folks with recording-grade use in mind, but at consumer-friendly prices. But of course, I can do you one better. If you shop the kit at meaudio.com and use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, you can save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. Once again, meaudio.com, meaudio.com. Shop some fun kit, promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, 10% off. Keep your ears and your wallet happy at the same time. I want to thank the folks at Me Audio for hooking up the promo code. Now, let's get on with the show.
Okay. Right age for a kid to have a smartphone. I feel you should try to delay for as long as is socially possible. Flowtech Wolf, thank you. You originally asked about this. So what my wife and I have decided is a multi-pronged strategy on how to handle Lex, technology, and social media. One, we do not share many photos of Lex across social media. I am not trying to besmirch the decisions that other families have made, especially other tech reviewer families, because they have different levels of comfort and they came to different conclusions. That is literally all I am saying. That we have made a different decision about how to handle Lex. Part of what informed our decision is both my wife and I came from Hollywood, talent, management, casting, and we both sort of appreciate the power of what goes into a contract or a negotiation when it comes to things like likeness rights. And I made a decision that I did not want to leverage part of the growth or success of my YouTube channel on making my adorable little baby girl one of the main features or models without her ability to contribute to a conversation about how her likeness would be used. And that also extended into just social media in general. My wife and I, when we grew up, we would have photo albums. And they would have all kinds of embarrassing baby pictures in them. But a friend of ours, often a girlfriend or a boyfriend, would have to come to the house where one of our parents would then pull out the embarrassing photo album book, and everyone would have a good laugh at our expense in one physical location with one set of photos, and that was the relationship. Sorry, I know I'm rambling here, but I am getting to a point. So we started Lex off with as minimal a footprint on social media as we could. When Lex turned 4? No, I we were already looking at this place. I started asking on the Discord, so I want to say maybe when she was 5. What we started doing was giving Lex individual purpose-built gadgets with no ability to go online without us being able to observe what she was doing online. And so the first thing that we started her off on, she was taking care of her own headphones. Later, we got her really nice noise-canceling Bluetooth headphones. And then when she was comfortable, like, plugging those in and charging them and putting them in their case and doing all of that. And we're talking about a 5-year-old, so this wasn't all at once. This happened over a period of time. Then we got her a little MP3 player. And the only ability for that thing to catch any kind of data is it's got a built-in FM radio. So that's it. Like, her ability to be unmonitored in catching some kind of information that we aren't privy to is FM radio. I'm sure she could still get herself into problems with an FM radio. Kids are very resourceful like that. So increasingly, she's 8 years old now, increasingly she is getting more unmonitored tablet time. There are a couple little games that she likes to play. She loves puzzle and clue games, things like Monument Valley. So we've started allowing her to expand on that. And we know next year in school, she's probably going to get a gut-rot Chromebook to help facilitate her schoolwork. She still does not get unsupervised time with YouTube. We'll let her browse on her own accounts for Netflix and Disney Plus, but we've put pretty strict limits in place on what she can get to on either Netflix Kids or on Disney Plus on a kid's account. I feel my daughter will probably start... Oh, and I'm sorry. The other thing that we've now started training her with is a smart watch. And I think... because she's already busted one of them, and I set it down. So this is an unfortunate name for a watch. It's called the TikTok, but it's not TikTok, the social media site. This is the one that she busted. So this is a little TikTok watch. It is very much like a Samsung Gear. So all those people who are calling me a Samsung hater, look at how accessible I had the Gear ready to go. The original big bangle Gear. This had a SIM card, and it was basically a little mini phone. Even has like a little home button right there. Flippin' loved this thing. I would kill to see Samsung return with something like this in the market as like a proper phone-replacing wearable. I digress. The TikTok is very similar to that, and it's got a little SIM card, and you can go with any carrier that you want that's compatible with the bands. You put in the SIM card. We're paying like $10 a month for her to have emergency contact services to us. This is how we LoJack our daughter. It's location-aware, but we highly manage what she can do on it. We strictly control who she can communicate with it. And as she gets older, we can use this to start opening up if she wants to send a message to one of her friends or something like that. So for my daughter, experiencing this slow ramp of technology, I feel we'll be talking about a proper cell phone of some kind maybe when she turns 10. I know my daughter, and my daughter is whip-crack smart. She is very clever. She's also a little emotionally immature for her age. Single child, 2 years of global pandemic. She's got a lot of life that she still kind of needs to experience and get up to speed with these social situations. And I feel putting a smartphone into an 8 or a 9-year-old's hands right now is a recipe for disaster. But I have made that decision for my family, and obviously that needs to be weighed against the maturity of the kid case by case by case. Like, if you're the third child in a family and you're parents of 2 older children, and you've got a third coming up and you've got a hand-me-down phone, and you can make that transition happen because those kids have seen the other 2 kids grow up in front of them, completely different situation. But our timetable right now is we're going to look at 10 for some kind of feature communication device that isn't a big chunky watch on her wrist. So we're going to use this smartwatch to transition her into a basic for emergencies mostly, communication device. And then from there, we need to see how she grows with that device, how she interacts with her friends on that device, and then we can start talking about some kind of smarter device. But she has always been using single-purpose technology. It's combining these gadgets that makes me a little anxious. She's got a pretty good eye for photography, but she's mostly shot from mirrorless cameras. Like, she has no interest in picking up my phone to snap a photo. But if I say, hey, do you want to go out on a walk? We can, you know, kind of shoot some photos. I've got to do something for an article. She'll be like, great. And she'll go and run and grab my old Panasonic. She doesn't think of the phone as the platform to do that because she has access to my old busted cameras. That's the kind of evolution that I think parents need to decide for their own kids. It's not just one day we flipped a switch and now they're exposed to technology and they have internet access. I feel it's way better to on-ramp and start small and build up and also let them fail. I don't think her MP3 player works anymore. She did an amazing job of taking care of that for 2 years. She destroyed this first smartwatch that we got her. It took a year, but a year of 6 to 7 year old abuse finally did this watch in. But we grow, and she kind of understands now the limitations of those things, and that's way less of a hit on our finances for her to destroy a little mini smartwatch and a little MP3 player than if we had waited until she was like 10 and then just given her an iPhone. It's to me, it's a process. It's never just this age is what is going to be most appropriate. It's what is the maturity of that child and what can you expect them to take care of? And that's going to be a different answer for every parent out there. Now, let me take a drink of water. We can wrap up some of these comments. And again, if anyone had questions about that or other follow-ups, or if you want to chat about OnePlus Open or Pixel 8 Pro, don't be shy with those questions either. Barry Johnson on the OnePlus Open. Video out! Kills me. Because like, we're pretty sure that the Pixel 8 Pro has video output, but it's software locked. And I would love to have video output on the Pixel Fold. It would be so good. Aditya Anil. Judging by how clean that 6x zoom was you posted on Discord, whatever magic OnePlus is doing, it's working. I am shocked by the OnePlus Open's telephoto. It's a little OmniVision camera sensor. Literally 2 weeks ago, we were making jokes about OmniVisions, and whatever OnePlus is doing with that telephoto sensor is shockingly good. Those early photos that I've shared, there's one. It's a squirrel in the shade. This is not an amazing, groundbreaking shot. I'm a better photographer than this one shot that I've shared. But it's crouching on this pole, it's in the shade, which would normally be a very difficult shot for a telephoto sensor, and I'm using the 6X, so it's a 3x optical zoom, and then you double that with a software crop, and it is so stinking detailed, and it doesn't look like it's just ratcheted sharpening, it looks like native resolution at 6x zoom. You can't count on it to always deliver that at 6x zoom, but man, that one photo just came out stunningly clear. Just really, really good. From Zhaobotnik, what's funny is, Zhaobotnik writes, does your girl even care about having a phone? One of the reasons why I say my daughter is a little emotionally immature, and I point to things like, we spent 2 years locking her up, and we were really strict about the lockdowns for the pandemic. She missed out on some of those like growing social conflicts, peer group interactions, and she's catching up now. I mean, it's not like I'm saying my daughter's stunted for life, but those earlier experiences or when she like sees people using a phone, I don't think she equates that with communication or freedom. She looks at grownups always looking down at their phones and, well, that's boring. I mean, we could be talking or playing a game or telling jokes or throwing food at each other or doing anything else. And I feel like increasingly, especially younger and younger people coming up, the smartphone looks like this obligation to your lifestyle. It doesn't look like the kind of freedom that I felt the phone was going to be in the early and disruptive days of mobile computing. So she doesn't think of the phone if she wants to take a photo. She loves picking up a big old camera. She doesn't think of the phone when she wants to listen to music because the music plays in the car and she had an MP3 player that she could control, that she took care of. And I think by starting her off that way, the phone isn't the end-all be-all, but I know as she gets older and her peer groups kind of niche down and become a bit more cliquish, especially getting closer to middle school, that's when it's going to matter more to her. Right now, she kind of knows they exist, but she also knows what I do for a living, and so it's really not interesting. Like, oh, Daddy got another phone. And there's a joke. I mean, since my daughter was six, I would go up to her and, hey, Lex, I know you were really worried that I didn't have enough phones. And she would yell, Dad, you've got too many phones. And you're like, yeah, but I needed another one. And she'd go, ah. Gotta love the dad jokes. But I think it's going to be a while before she is putting the social experience on the phone to a degree where it would matter to her. Oh, man, awesome possum. I've been able to hold off on games for my five-year-old almost this whole time. This weekend, we got hit with an entertainment fee at Red Robin for using the checkout kiosk games at the table, and now she is asking for games. Not like this. Not like this. So get in there and be a part of your kids' gaming experience. I'm writing a presentation that I'm going to try and give to my daughter's school for the parents. Because people my age and younger have no clue what their kids are doing and playing these games. And I'm seeing like six-year-olds running around with Roblox accounts, completely unfettered access to gaming platforms, online gaming, chat rooms, friends groups, like the perfect sort of petri dish for creepers to go in and abuse kids. And oh, you know, they just like to play their games, and if I try to take their game away, they get real sad. And you're like, but that's what, but you're a parent. And so for me, it's like, oh, but I checked out the game rating, and it said E for everyone. Or T for teen, and they're mature. They've seen the Marvel movies. They can play the Marvel games. Why is my credit card bill so high? And to me, it's like the game content is the least important part of a conversation with your kids on gaming. Get in there and have them play some reflex games. Get in there and get them to play some arcade racing games and kart racers, things that are so fun to play with their friends. Get in there and get a brawler going with some Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. You have not lived until you've had 4 7-year-olds screaming at each other over who gets the pizza in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. But they were there passing snacks back and forth, making an absolute mess of my controllers at home, and it was amazing. And I loved it. So, it like, share those experiences, and you can totally teach. My daughter can get to a Reaper. She can't kill it yet, but she can get to a Reaper in Vampire Survivors. She's completing tracks in, well, what is that really cheesy arcade racer game that's on Epic right now? It's not Horizon. Oh, I can't remember what it's called. But it was like one of the free Epic games. And I was like, ah, it's a little racing game. It looks like a modern version of like a California Racing. And I fired it up. I was like, okay, this is actually kind of fun. Both my daughter and I were playing that for like days. That's what we need to do. And as soon as you let the gotcha mechanics and the gambling machine mechanics of a game kind of worm their way into your kid's brain, you're never going to get them off that dopamine hit. It's the worst. There was another article that just got passed around on Lemmy, the Reddit clone, about researchers were looking at, I can't remember what games they were. Oh, FIFA. Researchers were looking at a predominantly male audience and talking about their addictions to FIFA. And their heartbreaking stories. Like, people in, one of the guys I think was in Central America and had like spent thousands on FIFA loot boxes and like couldn't tell his wife how much of their money he had thrown away. So when my daughter is interested in gaming, if it's something that I can't sit and play with her, I'm trying to point her towards clever mechanics. Monument Valley, it warps your brain, and she feels so excited when she figured out the solution because the game feels like you outwitted the game. Even though it's exactly what the game designers wanted you to do, you feel like you did something subversive. She comes, she's so excited she did it. She's cleverer. She beat the game. Likewise, if it's something that we can sit side by side on the couch, we've got a really good patter going on with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. She knows how to rescue me. I'm looking at health. We're upgrading the new characters from the DLC. Oh, Lex, you need to get the pizza. You're running really low. Okay, come back over here and then use your super attack. Oh, no, the boss is going to mess us up. And it's communication. And we're working together. It's all about conflict resolution on a team. And you add that to some board games and stuff like that, and you can do so much better for your kids than, like, the just awful gotcha mechanics and slot machine and RNG that so many of our games work in. Colonel Corn Pop, I have no idea what this is. What I would trust a kid with? A handheld ham radio, a knife, and some gumption. Kids used to be made of sterner stuff. Zhao Botnik, does the Pixel also have the Google search bar on the home screen you can't remove? Of course. I mean, that's really been a thing since, what, Android 11? I believe that's when they locked in the Google search bar on the screen that you couldn't get rid of. It's just a Pixel thing at this point. To me, it's like, oh no, Xiaomi phones now don't let me customize the notification tray. Guess I can't use a Xiaomi ever again. It's just the thing that kind of becomes a defining element of what is a broadly accessible smartphone experience. Like, it's a Google phone. Search is critical. Assistant is critical. All of that stuff is really baked in hardcore to the Google experience, so they put it front and center. The Pixel is not a phone about customization. The Pixel is a Google-first version of what Android could look like. And so if you're not tapped into all the Google services and stuff, you might... Oh, I just turned it on by saying the G word again. Sorry, I know I'm probably also kicking on a whole bunch of other people's phones there. But that's a part of the flavor. If I want a more photography-focused experience, I'm probably going to look at Sony or Xiaomi or Vivo. If I want a more multimedia experience, actually Samsung is pretty good. You've got DeX. Motorola kind of wiggles in there too with Ready 4, and then they become better productivity options. I mean, again, it's never just... Android is one thing, and phone is one thing, and phone does phone things. If you want a screamer, high-performance phone at a reduced cost, you can look at Pocos, you can even look at OnePluses. I mean, it ranges the spectrum. And so I know a lot of people, oh, you can't even move the search bar on a Pixel. Yeah, but you're complaining about something that kind of got locked in a couple years ago, and I'm never one to say, like, oh, don't be annoyed by what you're annoyed by, but... You could pick your battles, man. If it bothers you that much, go buy another phone. If you want all the other things that make a Pixel, then yeah, you're going to have a search bar on your home screen. I kind of feel like that's like a massive component of what makes a Pixel. Oh, Baseball Super, in addition to, yeah. Baseball Super says, I think you want video out for one reason. It's to use your AR glasses, right? What do you do on your AR glasses commonly? So first of all, I want it to be known, I want video out for monitors and TVs and portable displays. It is the best upgrade you can make for your current collection of gadgets is to invest in some kind of portable screen. A portable monitor that can go all over your house, that can connect to phones and laptops and tablets and game consoles. This adds so much additional functionality to the gadgets you already own. So I get a laptop, I get a little portable display, I put it next to my laptop, and wow, now I've got a dual display portable work solution anywhere I want to go. The XR glasses are one of the more exotic flavors of adding that second display. So for me, it's often entertainment, but increasingly I'm relying on them for work. So I just recently did a flight. We flew to Albuquerque, and it's an hour and a half flight. You're in the air for an hour and a half. Yet I had them plugged into my phone. I'm streaming content from my phone on the stupid little app that the airline had, and I'm watching part of a movie because we couldn't even go a full movie. We weren't in the air that long. But I'm watching it in the most comfortable way that I can. I can pull out my Steam Deck, play a video game in the most comfortable body position that I can sit in. And now I'm starting to rely on it more, where maybe I'll take a little folding Bluetooth keyboard, and it's never the optimal aspect ratio, but even on the OnePlus Open, I had a Bluetooth keyboard, a Bluetooth mouse, XR glasses, and I was writing part of the script for one of my videos on that setup, and it takes up so little space. You know, like, this is a big portable display, and it's the size of a laptop, because it's a laptop, it's a lap dock, it's a laptop dock. I don't need to take a phone or glasses out of my carry-on when I board the plane. If I have this and some sunglasses, they stay in my backpack. You go through airport security and they're like, make sure anything that's bigger than a cell phone is put in its own bin. Not me. So increasingly, it's like I'm starting to rely on them more and more. And every now and then I'll still like be walking around the house. Marie's watching something in the bedroom. Lex has got one of her kids' shows on the TV in the living room. I'll be like, yeah, I want to watch Suits, but I don't want to watch it on a little screen. So let me just break out these glasses. And I'm watching a giant movie theater projection of a remarkably mediocre but hilariously fun show. Oh, Michael Pepertech was in the chat. What's up? Michael MPT must have heard when I was praising him again for hipping me to those Pixel cases. Hold on, let me get this out. Muppinish, you need to 1v1 your kid to show her who's boss in Quake. I don't think she's not ready for Quake yet. Oh, and I think we've kind of caught up to the rest of them here. Yeah, Colonel LG used to have those animated weather screens. Animated weather on the lock screen. That's how you would say it. You wrote it right there. It's nice to see some of that kind of coming back to phones. Again, like, not everything needs to be flat, harsh, and minimalistic. Sometimes it's nice to have something a little goofy animated into the experience. All right. Well, folks, I knew this was going to be a longer show just because we had a lot to catch up on. Thank you, everybody, who tuned in last week, because we had really good numbers on that stream last week. It was really exciting to see. Those essays take so long to produce, and that one I was really proud of how it came out. But, of course, it's a part of this conversation that people really bristle at when you point out trends in commentary and how, no one wants to feel like my fandom for this brand is starting to harm other aspects of this industry, but we've got to take that look at what is it that we're doing with our time? How are we supporting these companies? And where else can we look for competition to make our products better? So really appreciated folks who weighed in on that and also helped support and share that stream and that podcast. I have a ton of stuff to work on. I've got some cool audio gear that's going to be coming to the channel very, very soon. I've got another mini PC build that I'm just going to be doing an overview on, and then I can finally break down some of the other fun project videos that I've been wanting to do. I've got some health tech that's a little funky, like not quite body hacking, but like mood and behavior hacking with wearable technology. That could be kind of interesting, I think. And then, of course, we've just got so much to follow up on with Pixel 8 Pro, OnePlus Open, wrapping up some older camera-focused reviews that I want to do some comparison between, like, Pixel Fold and OnePlus Open for cameras on foldables. And then TK and I are going to be doing another twofer video looking at Open versus Z Fold and Open versus Pixel Fold. So that's going to be sort of a joint collaborative pair of videos coming to both of our channels. Oh, and I just finally installed the screen protector on my Pixel Watch. So I feel a little bit better taking this out. I've had two different border cases for the Pixel Watch. Both of them are back ordered. So I've got them on order. Eventually they're going to get here, but I really want to wear this watch, and it makes me so anxious to wear this with curved glass. So I'll be talking about my protection of the Pixel Watch 2, and it's kind of the same as talking about my protection of the Pixel 8 Pro. Not a fan of the curved glass, guys. Not a big fan of wraparound glass edges on something that is constantly smacking against walls and door handles and stuff like that. So, folks, thank you so much for tuning in. Oh, and I need to do this. If anyone wanted to stall my exit here, Muppinish. Juan doesn't have a soundboard. Fanfare of glory to Muppinish for gifting tier one subs to Otaku and Vince Novoa. Thank you so much, Muppinish. You have been so generous, and I really appreciate it. Folks, we are peak tech, end of the year, rolling into the holidays. We know there are going to be crazy sales. We know there are going to be fun combos and trade-ins and all this stuff as we kind of lead out 2023, which for the whole industry has been kind of a rough year, but I feel like this is a little pocket. This is a little window where we can get a little bit more excited. We can have a little bit more fun, and we can look at all this stuff as we've gone through the whole year and say, okay, now I can make some decisions. Maybe this is what I want for an upgrade. This is maybe where I'm going to plan ahead for next year. And we know we're going to be getting some huge information coming from Qualcomm and MediaTek. We know that Xiaomi and Vivo are going to be hitting the ground running at the end of this year to get ready for next year. We don't really have a lull from the end of the summer through Techtober through Thanksgiving. It's just go time until finally everybody collapses around New Year's, and then we're getting ready for CES. So folks, this is going to be a roller coaster ride as we get through the next couple weeks and the next couple months. Thank you so much for tuning in. Everybody out there, take care of yourself, especially take care of yourself so you can keep taking care of others. Be those good tech neighbors that I know you are. I'll catch you back here next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. Be safe. Take care. I love y'all. I'll catch you back.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.